I have this report from the commander of the 4th Army Corps. Serbian troops have fired on our positions of steamers on the Danube. Our troops, in order to defend themselves, were forced to return the enemy fire. A considerable skirmish developed. Assassination, terrorism, failure to accede to our legitimate demands, etc., etc. Austria now at war with Serbia.
The more so since Serbian provocateurs are already attacking Austrian troop positions.
Hostilities have already begun.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Bristol Politics Show, the 13th Friday of March. Well, it's not the 13th Friday, but it's Friday the 13th. My favourite Friday the 13th is my favourite thing, where those nasty Knights Templars all got their collars felt by the French King back in 1307. And then subsequent trials, and I'm not quite so sure he really deserved to be burnt at the stake, Jacques de Molay, but at least they were humiliated. And the most important thing, of course, was the truth came out about what these guys were up to, this little branch of the Vatican called the Knights Templar and their horrid, horrid crusade that Pete Hegseth loves, doesn't he? Loves it, all that. Maybe something similar should happen to him, that he should be exposed. But anyway, so it's Friday the 13th of March, 2026, streaming live. We're streaming live from the Corner of Freedom, close by Bristol to City Centre, known as the Cumber Centre. Don't believe a word we say, but we do try to share moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar port, turned merchant venturer fiefdom in the City of London's UK Empire of Lies, to quote Putin. And he's right, of course. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at djplugradio.co.uk, in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com, Central Time, 11 a.m. till 2:30 p.m. On 87.7 FM, West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app, available free from GitHub and Apple App Store, but not from evil Google Play. Oh, by the way, Putin also censors things, yeah? Quite a lot of censorship going on over there too, as I remember from my wonderful days on RT. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the Talk Radio stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. This week we've got exclusive with Sabine McNeil, who's a former CERN engineer back in the 1980s and 90s, and she was also involved in a Hampstead child abuse case and jailed for 4 years, now over in Germany working on more networking and internet revolutionary products, plus also former Bahrain ambassador Peter Ford and deputy leader of George Galloway's, well, it seems to have migrated abroad, but anyway, the Workers' Party of Great Britain and Hong Kong. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero trust agenda psyops, bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify, or boring us to tears with BBC adverts about just how wonderful they are and how much you can trust them. So it shows how desperate they are. Puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs. Oh, I thought the BBC weren't supposed to advertise. No, but they can advertise themselves, and how truthful they are. Puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes. So anyway, McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the rentier class. The Crown prosecutes us for praying, that is Tampon Charlie and the Vampire Queen, for unborn children, and the only right they want us to have is our so-called right to kill ourselves. Well, the death cult are doing quite well in not just killing us and giving us the right to kill ourselves, but also taking away our basic needs, so that people are committing suicide at an enormous rate as well. Just somebody else up on the bridge here in the M32 in Bristol the other day, and I'm thinking, just give them a roof over their head, give them food, this sort of thing. This is what people want, and once they're treated like that by a government, then they don't want to go throwing themselves off the bridge, do they? Or far less, anyway. So the Netanyahu, who's the king of chaos, is rolling out his red carpet for the Zionist man, God, Antichrist, Messiah to come. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? So helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich and World War III, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
So what's your big take home from this week?
Well, obviously the war is escalating, and all the stuff I'm reading is everybody trying to chew over the consequences of that. And of course it's an exponential thing, so next week it'll escalate it again.
You don't think this is going to be ending anytime soon? We're talking to Peter Ford, the former Bahrain ambassador later. He thinks it will maybe only last another couple of weeks.
Well, we shall have to see, but I think the problem is that everybody's locked in now to an escalatory spiral. So even if people want to stop, it's not necessarily clear that they can.
No?
No. Trump's talking about, we're going to have a negotiation with Iran. Iran has said, we're not going to negotiate with
you. Well, Trump can say that's it for now, can't he? He can say that any time he wants.
And he can, because the Iranians have got a say in this and said, we're not negotiating with you. Mm. The time for talk is over.
So it's a bit depressing, isn't it?
Well, it is very depressing, but world wars are like that until you've lost or won, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And just on before we get to plunge in to talk about Iran, obviously most of today's discussion coverage is about that. But I thought we'd have a listen to an interesting piece about antidepressants, because for quite a while I've been searching around and I can't find a really good article about antidepressants, but there seems to be lots of people who have been put onto these antidepressants and having an absolute terrible time. They are addictive in that as soon as you start to try and come off them, it sends you quite often into psychotic episodes. So they're addictive, they're also very bad for you when you're getting older and if you have any kind of signs of dementia. But still, sometimes people are being described these drugs extremely bad, and they send you into a sort of void, really. And they can do. I mean, there may be one or two people who've had a useful experience with them, but mostly extremely bad. Anyway, there is at least, thank God, there is some good treatments around there for, I suppose this is just depression, but I mean, it's also to do with people's life circumstances. Back in the old days, of course, you would go to see the local vicar or somebody like that if you're feeling depressed, and they would give you a bit of a spiritual lift. They wouldn't necessarily depend on drugs to relieve the symptoms. Of course, the cause is what is needed to sort out with something like depression. But anyway, drugs, there's a drug for everything, isn't there? Including obesity, where actually you could just fast and sort it out that way. But for some reason, we're being told, no, for all these traditional spiritual methods, forget them. We got a drug for that, and they're making money out of that, of course. Anyway, let's have a listen now to this. It's a new technique which has been developed by a lady called Joanna Moncrief, and it's called Open Dialogue. It was looked at on Radio 4 a couple of months ago.
The NHS is currently trying out a new approach to treating mental illnesses. It's called Open Dialogue. It has been used in Finland for many years, and six trusts in England have been running a clinical trial. Now, the results aren't in yet, but Open Dialogue has certainly attracted some devotees. Essentially, the approach is all about organised conversations involving the patient, some of the patient's family and friends, and two trained facilitators to listen and oversee the proceedings. Now, we'll hear from one of the consultants leading the trial in a moment, but first, someone whose family's used Open Dialogue and is now, in fact, running a charity that promotes it, is Rachel Bannister, who co-founded the charity Mental Health Time for Action in 2017. And she did that after years of struggling to access appropriate mental health treatment for her then teenage daughter. And she described how a session of Open Dialogue works.
So our first meeting, you'd sit in a room and there'd always be two practitioners who are trained in Open Dialogue alongside you. And you'd already have asked the patient, who else would you like to be there? So, you know, for some people that might not be anybody because they might not be ready to do that. But we've got to the point now, so we'd have other family members in the meeting as well. And the first thing you say, there's no agenda. There's no, like somebody says, with a clipboard and a tick list and agenda. It's how would you like to use the meeting today? What do you want to talk about? But the really unique thing about this way of working, the practitioners will suddenly stop and they'll say, would it be okay if we reflect on what we've heard? And they turn to each other and they talk about what they've heard you say, their feelings about it, and what they think might be helpful. It's that transparency, that openness. No decisions are made without the patient there. It's all done in the room.
Has the outcome on your daughter, you would say your daughter is a satisfied customer?
Yeah, well, I've got two daughters that are in a seat of open dialogue. One who's had all the trauma of, you know, treatment as usual. So her recovery is, I feel, is going to be much slower, but I could definitely see change, and she can see change, and it's wonderful. My younger daughter started last February, and she was very isolated, on benefits, unable to work, signed off work, 6 months of open dialogue, got through her A-levels that she did online by herself, and she's at university, 120 miles away. So that improvement has been quite dramatic. And it's taken us all by surprise.
So Rachel Bannister there thinks it does have an effect, a good effect. The consultant psychiatrist, Russell Razak, is the co-leader of the NHS trial. He came into the PM studio earlier to tell me more about how open dialogue works.
The first thing is that instead of treating people as an individual who need to be seen on their own and treated sort of as a personal brain, we bring together a community around them. That could be friends, it could be family. And then the second thing is the clinicians are very different. They're part of that network, but an equal part of that network. So it's a lot less hierarchical. Rather than we're in charge, we're the experts, we tell you what's wrong with you and we give you, you know, the sort of plan. And then the third thing is we make sure that what we call network meetings stays with the patient throughout their time in care. So you don't go from one team to another team, you know, new professionals every time you're in crisis. So it's built around forming this network around the person and having this collaborative dialogue where we give them this sense of agency so they can start taking charge of their own care, using their own resources, and ultimately, hopefully, becoming more independent, relying on hospital less, relying on sort of severe crisis care a lot less.
Yeah, and do we think it does? It's a form of talking therapy in a way, because you're talking. I mean, that's what it is. These meetings.
Yes.
Do you think it leads to less medical therapy being prescribed?
Well, the best metaphor is it's like a carpet on which you can put any furniture. So you can use medication, you can use, you know, therapy, you can use all sorts of things with it. It's a way that we organise our care. So people can ask for anything as part of that. But in the end, yeah, people will, in other studies that what they've done in other parts of the world, they've found that actually people end up using medication less. They still use it if there's, you know, severe need and there's real distress, but they use medication less. They'll still use one-to-one therapies if they need it on top of that. So all sorts of things are a part of it. But yeah, you know, they'll often find a great deal of sort of healing comes about just through having this collaborative dialogue that goes on the whole time they're in care.
Okay, but it isn't just the therapy in itself. It's a way of organizing.
Right.
All the therapy that you might receive as a patient.
Right.
The NHS has struggled to offer consistent, timely, comprehensive treatment to everybody who feels they need it in mental health.
Yeah.
Despite the fact there's a goal of parity between mental and physical conditions.
Yeah.
If this works, if the trial results come out really positive, is this a practical way of advancing the NHS's offer on mental health?
So ultimately it is, because if this works, in other countries what they've tended to find is that people end up a lot less chronic. So they end up less in this revolving door where they're coming back again and again and again, needing lifelong readmissions to hospital. So if you can change the sort of nature of mental health care, where it's actually focusing a lot of attention on people early on and not needing to have people coming back to us all the time, then yeah, we can start to, you know, deal with our demand in very different ways. But it would mean, you know, investing in a different model, a different culture, new training, and getting people to organize their systems in a way that isn't really about keeping people stuck in there for so long.
Yeah, so there would be upfront costs, because you have to, you'd have to devise it and roll it out. I mean, the two facilitators who sit in the room and are part of the conversation, do they take as much training as a psychotherapist, psychoanalyst?
Not as much. I mean, a psychoanalyst, psychotherapist is 3 or 4, sometimes 5 years training. And we managed to do a sort of 1 year training that involved sort of partly residential, partly in-house, and we've formed permutations of that since then. So we've got a way of delivering it that is accessible to people within about a year who are in full-time jobs in the NHS, doctors, nurses, OTs, you know, psychologists. So it's doable as long as you're currently in work and you can test and start using the techniques from day one.
I mean, just listening to you, it doesn't sound like that clever an idea. This is what I find a bit odd. It's like, let's get a few people who know the patient, let's all sit around and talk through this. In a very, you know, a managed way, intelligent way.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just doesn't seem that kind of radical in a way.
And a lot of people say that, actually. And a lot of people who are not in the mental health system say, well, isn't this obvious? And, Yes, and I look forward to the day when this is how we organise our services and people will say, surely you always did it this way. But the thing is, our services have become very individual focused. It's like, this is your problem, let's talk to you, let's medicate you, let's deal with you on your own, and the answers will be in the minds of the clinicians. And so it does sound common sense from outside the system. Inside the system, we are so individually focused that it does require quite a revolution in the system to do this, and for clinicians also to work about, you know what, I'm not really the expert in someone's condition. If someone's hearing voices, and they and their family have been through this, I haven't, they're the experts on what this is really like. Our big goal is to increase agency of the patient all the way through.
That was Russell Razak there, consultant psychiatrist on this approach called Open Dialogue. They're testing it at the NHS, and the results should be out in the next few months. And he's an academic at the University of London.
So there you go, Martin. At least now they've now decided that whisking patients away, once they get if they get diagnosed with depression and whatever they say, oh, I'm feeling depressed. Whether it's to do, as this case may, it sounds like, is to do with somebody that can't get a job, they feel like their life is not going the right direction, it's worthless, they haven't got a relationship, family, that sort of thing, that actually antidepressants can send them down into a spiral, even though it says on the tin it's an antidepressant, what it does is it often makes them worse, and then they get hospitalised, they'll get sectioned, etc. But this approach seems to me to just be about open dialogue, about common sense, and let's just try to make sure that, for example, they're not passed from pillar to post with a whole new bunch of people every few months coming across this person as they go through the system and having to get to know them, and the whole thing is, it sort of turns into this approach where it's almost arm's length. The person is not a person anymore, they're just a subject.
Well, I mean, there's been a long-standing critique of mainstream psychoanalysis and medical interventions on this. And, of course, there's a big question about Big Pharma just wanting to push drugs because that's where they make their money. I mean, a massive amount of NHS expenditure goes on that. But, of course, underpinning all of this, I will say, as an economist rather than a psychoanalyst, is that all of this stuff, if it's done properly, costs money. And where's the money gone? It's gone to the banks. It's gone to fighting a war in Afghanistan.
Well, the money, a lot of it has gone to drug companies.
Well, that's, I've just made that point. Some of it goes to drug companies. And, of course, the budget for the NHS is under constant pressure because we've got to fund the war with Russia and all the other things
we've got to do. Well, when people are taken into the mental health system, I didn't realise this, just looking around it on search engines, there's mandatory medication. So they have to be given some kind of drug when they go into the mental wards nowadays. It's called mandatory medication. Now, this is cruel, surely. I mean, not everyone needs these pills.
No, but of course, sectioning is often non-voluntary. Yeah, people are sectioned. Like, we are sectioning you means we are taking you to a place of safety.
But if you go voluntarily, voluntarily, you know, yes, I'd like to go to this mental ward, they're not necessarily telling you. By going into this mental ward, we are now empowered to keep you here, number one, and number two, to medicate you.
Yes, those have been the rules for a very long time, Tony. And, of course, what sometimes happens is because people are slipping through the net and they're not being medicated, or they are being medicated but it's inappropriate and they should be looked after but they're not, and they end up stabbing people who they shouldn't really be wandering the streets. And that's happened quite a lot in recent times.
Yeah, they seem almost to be almost like places where maniacs are brewed up in mental hospitals. If you've got some staff that haven't got that person's best interests at heart with regard to they have to medicate them, even if they don't really necessarily need it, that's going to build up resentment. It can make people even more mentally ill within those. And then when they try and get released, maybe jump over the fence or something, then that actually cranks things up and they're even more incarcerated. So there's something desperately wrong here.
Yes, but if you remember, they closed down all the mainstream mental hospitals in the 1980s.
Care in the community. Care in the 1990s community. It was. Victoria
Bottomley. That's right.
Yeah.
So in other words, that is actual fact. I think, I'm not an expert on this, I've got no training in it, but it's obvious the common sense approach is you minimise medical medication, and it's, I mean, I know people who are mentally ill at the moment, quite close to me, and what they really want is talking therapy, which is what this sounds like. But you know the waiting list for that, Tony? It's absolutely ridiculous.
So cognitive behavioural therapy is another thing that can actually apparently help.
Well, yes.
Again, it's not a drug.
No, I
it's
know.
A person.
Yes, but that person needs a salary unless they're going to do it for nothing. And that, of course, costs money, which is where I come back to. We've got to get the money. All the money's required because we've got to build up our forces to fight the Russians, Tony.
Just within the NHS, it's not even that, is it? If you follow Johnny Bedmore's stuff, for example, he's in Cardiff and he does regular blogs. I can't remember the name of his blog right now, but anyway, I'm sure you can find it if you want. What he's pointed out is that the Zionists like Nicole Junkerman have got themselves implanted into running this thing called NHS Digital, and they are convincing government, they're convincing health secretaries, the modern day Matt Hancocks, whoever they are, or Virginia Bottomley as she was back in the 90s, they're saying to them, well look, by investing in AI and in digital technology, you can save so much money through treatment.
Yes, and that is basically a scam in my view. The modern Labour government has bought into it, which is why Palantir have got access to all of the NHS. I mean, the NHS is a public institution. The data it collects is public data, and it should be protected because of the individuals involved. What basis of an American Zionist-run company to have access to NHS data in this country? Loads of people who work in the NHS who've come to our protests and so on about what's going on in Palestine have made this point. And there isn't really a case for it. But, of course, what's happening now, Wes Streeting has said, well, we've increased money on the NHS compared to the Tories, but the quid pro quo is we've got to modernise it, which means we've got to let all these Yankee companies in to control the data, which, of course, is wrong, all wrong.
So I think we should probably get straight into the Iran side of things. A couple of interviews we've got later on in the programme with Peter Ford, etc., is going into into detail with his history working over as British ambassador in Bahrain, etc. And also I've got an interview with the boss of BitChute, which was grabbed by Dan Dix at some recent convention in Mexico, I think it was, maybe even in Mexico City. But these are the sort of, okay, so once we know what's going on, we can look at how that information has been being presented. But let's start with listening to talk radio with the British. I mean, it's the only time I've seen Richard Dalton pop up. He may have been elsewhere, folks. You may have heard him on BBC, etc. But this is the only time I caught him, which was on Talk TV. That is to say, the Murdoch-owned, the Genie Energy-owned, the Zionist channel called Rupert Murdoch, which owns The Times and The Sun and Talk TV, Talk Radio. They don't own Sky anymore. They don't own Sky News, although I think he's got a large share in it. He's not actually the owner anymore, Mr. Murdoch. But anyway, so here is the former British ambassador to Iran, and his name is Richard Dalton, or Sir Richard Dalton, talking, and he was from between 2002 to 2006, talking about the military side of the war, but also about these accusations of the Iranians trying to get nuclear weapons.
Why do you think nations now are going to trust the United States' word? Why do you think they will be prepared simply to have conventional weaponry when they face such odds all over the world against their adversaries? They will go the nuclear route, like Kim Jong-un.
Well, we know lots of countries
in North Korea.
Well, we know lots of countries have done that, don't
we? That will be in history, connected to the unjustified destruction of Iran on false pretexts.
Okay. I couldn't disagree with you more on all of that. But you talk about the destruction of Iran. Is it not the case that actually these have been highly targeted, military strikes? They've not been targeting you know, civilians. And we still don't know the truth about that girls' school next to an IRGC facility, who was responsible for that. But I doubt very much it would have been targeted deliberately by the US forces, unknowingly by the US forces. We're not seeing the destruction of Iran. That's quite the opposite from what we're seeing from reports, that actually these are highly targeted military targets, leadership targets, rather than the actual, you know, the people themselves, the, you know, their energy facilities, their water desalination and the like.
You're just putting lipstick on the pig. The fact is, Trump says we are destroying Iran. Moreover, the gross environmental crime of attacking all those oil facilities around Tehran is but one example. They are attacking fire stations, police stations, 12 hospitals, according to the WHO, have been damaged. And yes, 168 children were killed, maybe by mistake. But they set out to provoke state failure in that country.
What's and wrong with that, given the state, the regime that runs that state? A state that has threatened the rest of the world, threatened its neighbours, threatens the existence of Israel and every Jew in Israel, threatened America, has been behind terror attacks and threats in this country, has been funding this, you know, basic chaos around the Middle East for decades now, that slaughters its own young people in the street, possibly 30,000-40,000, even more than that, simply for asking, you know, to have basic civil rights and not women not to have to cover their hair. Why wouldn't it be the moral and good thing to try and oust that regime?
Well, they're going rather further than ousting that regime, are they not? They are trying to destroy the viability of the Iranian state. They are risking a breakup of the country into warring parties. They are risking leaving behind the Islamic Republic in a more ferocious state of mind. Now, I'm not justifying the four or five issues in which we have, and I personally conducted, actions against in connection with Iranian policy. But responsible governments have to look at the range of possible consequences mm-hmm. and to decide whether what they intend to do is too risky or acceptable. Now, the first test is international law. The second test is whether you're going to leave Iran in a worse position and the international community in a worse position, as the United States did in attacking Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. The United States' record in the Middle East is appalling, quite apart from arming and conniving at genocide in Gaza.
Oh, well, so, that, oh, I'm going to end that now. So, Richard, we're out of time anyway. There was no genocide in Gaza. I'm genuinely, with all due respect to you, sir, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed by my own government, although the government actually even admits, but a lot of the ministers, that a former British ambassador in Iran could claim that there was genocide in Gaza, when even the stats given by Hamas themselves do not even remotely suggest there was any attempt or certainly the achievement of genocide in Gaza. That's an absolute nonsense, with all due respect.
I have a right of reply to that.
Very quickly, if you could, Sir Richard.
Your opinion contradicted by a great many international, including Jewish experts in genocide.
Yeah, it's there are lots of experts in genocide would say very different.
It's a question of the effect. The point is, Iran was contained. This war was unnecessary.
Okay. I disagree with that. I'd love you to come back. We've got a bit more time and we can talk a bit more longer about this.
So you haven't got enough time, but you have got time for you to waffle on and pontificate, Ms. Hartley Brewer. So it's quite interesting to see, isn't it? This is, I would say something like maybe a quarter of all former ambassadors, when they retire, they do feel that they can speak their mind. They'll go on the TV and radio and talk about these things. It's lovely to hear. There are several of them, people like Peter Ford, we're about to hear a little bit later on. And, of course, Craig Murray, former ambassador, who's very vocal. article in opposition to the maniacal policies of the West in trying to force these regime changes and wars all around the world, well, particularly in Ukraine and Gaza and Iran. But what do you make of his point there, that they haven't really thought this through, Martin?
I think that's pretty obvious, really. I mean, Julia Hartley Brewer, I believe she went to Oxford and studied PPE as I did. But is she an expert in the way this guy is? You don't get to be British ambassador to Iran by being an ignoramus, do you? Unlike Julia Hartley Brewer, who's basically a big mouth on the radio.
So a slaughter of about 100,000 civilians, well, it's between 80 and 100,000 civilians, because of what they believe and their faith and their ethnicity, that sounds like genocide to me. I don't know how you would define what's happened. Is it some sort of, like, accident? The bombs got thrown around in the wrong place by mistake?
What that is just it's just denial, which is not just a river in Egypt. I mean, the fact is that we can say this is an allegation of genocide, which has gone to the International Criminal Court and to the International Court of Justice. And Julia Hartley Brewer can't just say, well, there is no case for genocide, because in actual fact, that's an ongoing case. There is definitely a case against Israel for being a genocidal state.
I mean,
plenty of countries have lined up to prosecute them. Julia Hartley-Brewer, who's a minor person, is not in a position to argue about that.
Yeah, well, she is employed because of who, you know, what she thinks, what she says. She's a propagandist for the genocidal Pax Judaica, Pax Zionica, whatever you want to call them. And these are the sorts of people that infest private media outfits all around the world that are owned by shareholders, the same shareholders that own oil fields, for example, in the Golan Heights.
Well, that's right. And, of course, under Ofcom rules, like we used to be under when we were on community radio, people, you know, you're supposed to actually give a fair go to everybody's views. Now, of course, in actual fact, they don't. And if you look at print media, it's absolutely clear that they just make it up. I mean, you know, they read The Sun every day and realize most of it's just made up. You don't need to know anything to write it. Now, the point is, people in that case have got to make their own judgments about what they're listening to, which is why, you know, we have media studies A-levels and so on for people to work out what's going on here. That interview was partisan in the extreme, yeah?
What she's doing is she's putting the opposite case to him. So you've got both sides. It's quite balanced.
Well, I suppose you could say that in one sense, except that she is also the interviewer, yeah? And therefore, if she had somebody who agreed with her on there, they'd just be both agreeing, wouldn't they?
Well, I think I should disagree with you more.
Well, indeed.
I mean,
the point is, people have got to actually make their own judgments. When they hear something like that, you've got to decide who's talking sense here. And it's not Julia Hartley Brewer, is it?
I rather like the attitude of Peter Cardwell, who's on the same Zionist channel. He says, disagree without being disagreeable.
Well, in theory, you can. But
can you do that? Come on, Mr. PPE boy, can
well,
you do
that? Well, you can sometimes, and other times, if people are about to hit you over the head with a baseball bat,
well,
you might
not
have to kick them downstairs.
We're talking about debate, Martin, aren't
no,
we? We're
I
talking
know.
About debate. You can, you could do this ad hominem thing where you attack the person and their own personal integrity rather than the argument. That seems to happen all the time.
Well, I'll just point out...
Which is what she was doing there, by the way.
Yes, I'll just point out that Marie Antoinette is a whore. And she sleeps with her gardeners. That's freedom of speech, but it leads to heads being chopped off. Is it okay?
Well, good question. I'm not sure it is, no. If you're lying...
That was absolutely the freedom of speech. If you look at all the pamphlets written in the French Revolution, the American Revolution, or the English Revolution, people just used to slag each other off. There was no attempt at objectivity. That's freedom of speech as well, isn't it?
Well, I suppose you're right. Reluctantly, I concede. But anyway, look, whereabouts are these wars cooked up? Because I do look more and closely every day at the organisations like Chatham House, Royal United Services Institute, Martin. That seems to be a lot of where these things are discussed. They're explored with military, live military. They play war games. They look at various scenarios. And they are privately funded.
Well, of course, ultimately, what's driving this particular world war is the financialized, deep state in the West, which has been there for about 500 years, gradually metamorphosing. And here we are at the final bit where it finally, you know, either gets what it wants or goes down.
Isn't it Netanyahu and his friends? They're leveraging the Yanks. I mean, the Americans, some of them are willing to do this, but many other Americans can see that this is insanity. People like your friend Michael Hudson are saying, well, this is going to crash our economy, it's going to crash the world economy, it's going to crash the United States out of the top league in the world.
Yes, I mean, and there are rational actors within the United States who are very well aware that this is a foolish manoeuvre. And, of course, there's a debate within the United States, are we being too under the thumb of the Israelis? But from the point of view of the people on the receiving end, what the Iranians are saying, we're not drawing distinctions now. We're not just... What happened in June last year is they attacked Israel. They had a symbolic attack on Al Udeid base, but they didn't...
This is in Qatar.
Yeah, that's right.
But the American base in Qatar.
Yes, and they gave them a warning so that they wouldn't have too many casualties. So in other words, the main retaliation in June last year was against the Israelis, and they basically avoided having a fight with the Americans. This time, they went straight for the Americans, straight for the jugular, because they're the ones with the big guns. Yeah. They're the ones who are responsible for this. You can say it's the Israelis made us do it. In fact, Rubio basically said that. We did this because the Israelis were going to attack the Iranians.
Had he said that?
He did. He came out and said the Israelis were going to attack the Iranians anyway. And then we knew that the Iranians would then fight us, so we thought we'd better go in with the Israelis and attack Iran before that happened.
This is exactly the argument that Putin used to go into Ukraine, isn't it? He said that Ukrainian Zelensky forces were about to attack the Donbass, so the best thing was to go in first. Now,
that's right.
This is you know, it's like pre-crime, isn't it? You don't wait for someone to attack you; you attack them first. Well, that really can lead to world war. That sort of idea.
Well, it does. It has done so twice.
It's Putin that set the precedent, isn't it?
Well, no.
Oh, yes, it is.
No, because what happened in the Ukraine is very similar to what happened in Yugoslavia, where it's not clear what the border is. In actual fact, in Yugoslavia, the borders that were drawn up by Tito were fought over.
The Ukrainian borders were very, very clear. And so were Yugoslavia.
No, they
were. There was a blurring with Kosovo, which you know.
No, 1991 is the first time that Ukrainian state has ever existed as an independent state. Yeah. And it was cobbled together.
In 2022,
by Lenin,
it was
Stalin,
absolutely clear. Okay, so in 2022, it was absolutely clear where the borders were.
No, it wasn't.
Yes, it was.
No, it
yes,
wasn't.
It was. Yes,
what
it was
offered in a Minsk agreement is you can keep the existing borders, but you've got to allow autonomy for the eastern regions where the people are fundamentally
Russian. Right, so there were existing borders, as I was saying.
Well, there is an existing border in Northern Ireland, Tony, but you can still have a war around it, can't you? Most wars have been fought over borders. They always are. Mm. There should be a border around Israel, the 1948 border.
Yes, but the Northern Ireland border is still there.
Yes.
It's still in the same place.
Well, the Israelis haven't got a border, have they? They haven't got a border.
They
just attack anybody they like.
It hasn't moved around. Neither, actually, has the Yugoslav borders are largely the same.
No, they're not. You'll find there's quite a bit of difference. The Croatians seized... what's it called, the Krajina, which was actually a Serbian majority area. I drove through it the day after everybody was driven out by a massacre, and that was actually they declared independence of Croatia because they were mostly Serbs.
Careful.
Well, that's right, because people can do that. Just like the Americans were part of the British Empire, and they said, we don't want to be part of it anymore, but it's not legal for you to say you're not part of it. We're going to have a war with you. But the Americans won, which is why they've got an independent country today, because they fought for it to change the border.
Is it really independent, America? Or is it still being manipulated by the Israelis and the British?
No, it's probably being manipulated by the City of London, Tony. That's what many nationalists in the US believe, and they're not necessarily wrong.
No.
Of course, people like Rupert Murdoch are married into the whole elites on both sides of... You know, the British and American elites are completely intermarried. Yeah? Boris Johnson is the son of an American woman, as Winston Churchill was.
Ultimately, how long do you think this is going to last?
Well, I think it's open-ended. When does it... It doesn't end. What they've been suggesting to the markets and the people who run the hedge funds is this is going to be over quickly and everything will go back to normal. And if you're a hedge fund person, you think, well, this is a good time to buy when all of the prices are down, and when it goes back to normal, we'll make a profit, which is why the stock markets haven't quite collapsed yet. But once it becomes obvious, and this could happen this week, that this is going to go on for 6 months, 6 years, like World War II... You know, then suddenly the people with the money are going to panic and they're going to sell. And then, of course, everything will fall, the roof will fall in. They're terrified of it, but they can't stop it.
Well, someone can. In fact, quite a few people can. Maybe people like Trump and Netanyahu, who don't care if the stock markets around the world collapse.
Well, undoubtedly, Trump's insiders are making money on every twist and turn of the policy because he's keeping them in the loop. So he knows first, he tells his mates, they then take a position on the market and they're making money out of it.
Yeah.
As people, well, profiteering is perfectly feasible.
I don't think anywhere
wartime.
Near enough attention is paid to these groups like Chatham House and Rusi, who do all these war games, scenarios, etc., to try these things out. And then they manage to convince themselves, as quite often happens when you're on that gravy train, that, oh yes, this can work, you know, and okay, it may be a bit chaotic, but we can move fast and break things and come out on top. So let's have a listen now to one of the chief, what is he, chief strategist? Director of International Security at the Royal United Services Institute. So he's one of the wonks that's been planning this for years and convincing people of what's going to happen when they go ahead with it.
From those strikes in the Gulf region this hour, we are hearing from the UAE that a drone attack has caused a fire in an industrial area. There's also been some quite loud bangs in Doha, according to reports, and there is some suggestion that the interceptors were fired. So we'll continue to watch those that situation there. Let's take a closer look at the strategy during the war and what Donald Trump says is the end game. We've been talking to Dr. Neil Melvin, Director of International Security at the Royal United Services Institute, and I asked him what the objective is now that the very aging Supreme Leader has been replaced by a 56-year-old younger version.
Well, I think, I mean, it depends a bit on what their objectives are, because the Trump administration has put forward quite a number of motivations, not really consistent, and they haven't articulated an overall sort of end goal for the war. So it's been rather open-ended from the very beginning. I mean, I think they will perhaps look at this a little bit like they did the Venezuela model, in which what they'll feel is that they have replaced the troublesome leader, they've pegged back the regime, and that the question now be about how to manage a new regime that's in place but is much limited in what it can do. And the guardrails have been really put on what that regime can do by US military power.
A lot of our focus this morning, of course, is on oil and gas and the cost of that to consumers. There's been talk about a military escort for tankers passing through the Strait of Hormuz. What would that look like and would it work?
Well, I think this goes to really the heart of what the US objectives are in this action. I mean, there is a larger strategic canvas that the US administration has been playing on, and that is their ambition to pivot their forces away from what they see as long-term sort of regional quagmires, commitments, policing commitments that they've had, notably in the Middle East, for many decades. A number of US administrations have professed the aim to leave the Middle East. And so some of the administration said this is the chance to do it, that Iran, which has been causing all these problems on the nuclear side through its proxy forces and just being sort of a regional troublemaker from a US perspective, that this military action can now take care of that. But if they then end up having to be a convoy service operating sort of to maintain oil markets, then that will defeat that purpose, because the whole idea is that the US should be able to move away from that. So they could convoy through. I mean, it would be dangerous, potentially, and they'd have to look at things like reinsurance of the shipping industry. But the US undoubtedly has the military power to make it very difficult to close the straits.
Well, that is, I mean, I was listening to that. I thought, well, that's a fairly reasonable, you know, the people in these think tanks aren't necessarily crazy people. They are paid to come up with stuff which is in the interest of the people who pay them. So the first bit was relatively uncontroversial. But when he says they can put convoys through the Strait of Hormuz, that's just patently not going to happen. How are you going to do that? It's just impossible. And I've been reading on the internet this week various people saying, when we get the, and Trump saying, well, we're going to put a convoy through. So how are you going to do that? You're not going to do that, because in actual fact, it's a death trap. And of course, loads of US military ships are trapped now in the Gulf, and they can't get out. And the Iranians aren't going to let them out either.
So they are letting some through, aren't they?
That's right. They're letting Chinese, through their friends.
Chinese, Russian, Pakistani, Indian.
That's right.
Ships are coming
as long as you're not attacking us, we will let your ships through.
A BBC report saying, well, it looks as if some of the ships are coming through, and we're not quite sure why. Well, that's because they're not American or European, and they're not allied with Israel. And if they're not allied with Israel, they will go through the Straits of Hormuz. I mean, you're right, though. I think he's totally deluded, this guy, if he thinks that you can have a convoy of tankers protected by destroyers, frigates, even an aircraft carrier, because what will happen is there will be either mines or there will be attack boats or missiles which can just pick off the tankers or even pick off the escort. I mean, this is only just a few miles from the coast of Iran. They can just see them. They can actually see these things
and launch missiles at them with line of sight.
Yeah, they don't need to be 5,000 miles away in Florida to conduct the operation. It's right on their doorstep, and they've been also preparing for this for 40 years.
Yes, I mean, there's another suggestion that they might be able to do an amphibious landing and then control the Straits of Hormuz, even if they can't control the rest.
Well, if you see Karg Island, they're talking about doing that. That is right up at the very top of the Straits of the Persian Gulf. It's miles away from the Straits of Hormuz.
It's a bit like Snake Island in the Black Sea, because the Royal Marines were encouraging the Ukrainians to seize Snake Island. And, of course, it's just a death trap. You arrive on the island, you're under continuous bombardment.
You have to laugh.
You can't get it.
It's farcical. This is silly talk by these so-called military. Anyway, let's have a listen to a bit more of our expert from Rusi, who you quite rightly said is moderating his comments a little bit, but then he does go off into la-la land. I wonder how that scenario went in his little war game.
If the Iranians wanted to target this shipping, would they then pop up on the target list for the Americans and the Israelis? I mean, would radars pop up, for instance, and would they be at risk of being hit?
I mean, there would be a risk, of course. I mean, because what the Iranians would use, it would be sort of land-based anti-ship missiles, and of course all ships have to go through the Strait of Hormuz, which is relatively narrow, so it would be, you know, the Americans and also the Gulf countries. You can't rule out they would get pulled in, and perhaps some of the Europeans too, in essentially making sure that there was no missiles that could be aimed on these ships as they did the transit. And that would be the game, is the Iranians would be trying to fire them off, and the Americans and its allies would be hunting them constantly.
The IDF has just put out a statement in the last few minutes saying a new wave of strikes has begun in Tehran. If they're up against the clock, if they believe that Donald Trump is now in the endgame scenario, what do you think they will want to focus on in the days ahead?
Well, I mean, the Israelis have been really just trying to degrade as much of the Iranian military equipment as they can. So particularly anything that might be sort of fired in the direction of Israel in the future. So they've been concentrating on ballistic missile systems, the drone systems, and also command and control. So I think we'll see an extra push on exactly those kind of targets over the coming hours.
Okay, so that he's from Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, the think tank, similar sort of organisation as Chatham House, and his name's Dr. Neil Melvin, is their head of international security. Look, these organisations, Martin, they do play a role, though, don't they? Whether it's Chatham House particularly, seems to be a sort of privatised version of the Foreign Office.
Well, I mean, I think the Royal United Services Institute was actually set up by the Duke of Wellington, if I'm not mistaken. People can check this. The existence of these think tanks, which are funded by the arms industry and some from governments, is to provide a kind of rationale for the policy and to discuss the policies that might be pursued. His statement there about the convoys through the Straits of Hormuz suggests that there is an element of you can't say things outside the box if you want to keep your job. So in other words, he's paid to say that, whether he thinks it or not. He probably does think it, because that's useful. If you believe the stuff you're saying, that's more convincing than if you don't. But nevertheless, it's stupid. Just stupid stuff. It just defies common sense to imagine that that's going to work out like that.
The leader of the opposition, Kemi Badenoch, official one anyway, even though they're very, very, very badly in the polls, is very gung-ho. She wants to see more and more Americans using British bases. Also worth mentioning that RAF Fairford, Gloucestershire here, up near Lechlade, not very far away from us at all. If there was a nuke went off there, we'd sure hear it here. And probably it might demolish or shake a few buildings in Bristol. But RAF Fairford has been being used to station these B-1 bombers, the US bombers, where these contain, what they're doing is they're having free fall bombs with a guidance system that attaches to the back end of the bomb. The idea is that you can steer it into a particular target after the bomb has dropped. But Britain is most definitely aiding. They're allowing the Americans to arm these aircraft and send them out. They come back late in the day, in the evening, from bombing Iran. In fact, sometimes early in the early hours of the morning. And they're doing sortie after sortie based at RAF Fairford here in Gloucestershire, exactly as the Prime Minister Keir Starmer says they would not be allowed to do.
Well, Starmer's position is frankly incoherent. He said, we're not going to... Obviously, nobody asked us to do what we thought about this. The Israelis and the Americans have decided to do this, and they didn't discuss it with the French, the Germans, or the British. So they were all kept in the dark. So, you know, we would be within our rights as a country to say, well, since you didn't discuss this with us, we're not going to support you. And in actual fact, of course, Spain has refused to let their bases be used to refuel, you know, to join in. And Trump has just said, well, you can't stop us using your bases. Yabu sucks to you. Now, at the same time, of course, the US is using the bases here in Britain to carry out its campaign of destruction against the civil infrastructure of Iran. They're not really hitting military targets, because most Iranian military targets are underground and they can't hit them. They can't get them. They don't have launchers. The serious missiles they've got don't use launchers. They've just launched from underground. Yeah, and the launchers they've got for the smaller missiles are actually just ordinary trucks. Any truck can be used.
It's quite likely, isn't it, that those are the sorts of targets these B-1s are heading for?
Yes, but the point is that they can't actually hit them. You know, they don't know where they are. And if you don't know where it is, you can drop your bomb, but it's not going to do much damage on the target.
Listen, I would have expected that the satellites can detect these launches of these ballistic missiles.
No, the stuff I've been reading says no, because in actual fact they're in tunnels where the ground is covered, so it just looks like a piece of ground. Yeah? It looks exactly like the ground neck nearby. And when it fires, it just fires from underground, and it just fires straight at you. And they've got them all over Iran, dug in, absolutely dug in. And I've also got mobile missiles, which are on the back of launchers, which are basically standard trucks. Any truck will do, and they move them around all the time. So
it's actually very difficult to know what's inside a container. That's very, very difficult to figure that out. And a container can just pop open, missile can be inside.
That's
of
right.
It.
And the Iranians
could be on a ship, or it could be on a lorry.
That's right. That's what
it could be on a train. Well, the train could pull into the sidings, and then suddenly pop, 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 loads of these containers, and nothing to do with transporting finished goods or whatever. Yeah. They are actually military.
That's right. So you've got two ways to hide your stuff. One is to dig it into the ground, like Hamas in Gaza, and the Iranians have been digging these tunnels for years now, and that the big stuff is all in the tunnels. The little stuff, they move around on standard trucks, which look exactly the same as any other standard truck. So, and of course, it moves around as well. So even if you've spotted it, by the time you've got your ODA, DDA, assessment in, ODDA it's called, I can't remember, it was invented in the 1950s. But I mean, it basically means that you've got a quick, you spot a target, and it's how quickly you can get to hitting the target, yeah?
So they're using satellites for this.
Well, satellites can be useful, but if you've got a satellite and you notice that there's a launcher from a truck, for example, by the time you've told your people where that truck is to fire back at it, it will have moved. Completely moved. It won't be there anymore.
It might have gone into a tunnel, and another truck might have come out the other end.
The point is, the missile that it fired is already on its way to wherever it's going, and you've not stopped it. And of course, the Iranians have thought this through. You know, they've thought it all through. They're fighting a defensive battle, but they're actually in a very serious position.
A good time
to cause
point out that actually the defender does have a big advantage.
Well, of course, it does.
even if the United States is such a long, long way away. Well, I mean, for example, this hitting of the bases in the Gulf states, which are being used by the US, I mean, it's quite clearly a smart move. It's putting diplomatic pressure on these places and saying, well, if you don't want any missiles, just boot the Americans out.
Well, that's right. And also underlying all of this is the possibility that all of these artificial family dictatorships created by Britain in the 19th century haven't really got very strong roots at all. And like in Bahrain, most of the population is in fact Shia and sympathetic to Iran.
I think you could probably say the Epstein class don't have very many proper roots at all. They're a small clique, effectively, aren't they?
They are. They are. And of course, they're all, you know, in actual fact, no doubt, the Russian general staff, for example, have a whole list of who's best friends with who, who's sleeping with who. Yeah, and they'll know.
Well,
who
that goes back right the way to the Cold War.
Well, exactly. Well, that's what you do. I mean, we're just extemporizing there. You know, we're not the FSB with a full list of all the people.
Well, you know who is? Is a guy called oh gosh, what's his name? Oh, anyway, the Reigns List chap. Alex Thompson, that's right. We're hearing a little bit of that a bit later on in the second half of the show, after we hear from Sabine McNeil. But look, let's have a listen, I think most importantly now, to the news this week about Peter Mandelson, as told by one of Martin's favourite people, that's Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Now, the Prime Minister claims that he was lied to. He wasn't lied to by this due diligence document. And it may be that Mandelson denied these claims. And if so, maybe the Prime Minister was lied to. But he was lied to by an inveterate liar who had been fired twice before. And we're supposed to believe, Madam Deputy Speaker, that the Prime Minister, who was once the chief prosecutor in this country, couldn't see through this nonsense.
And the Prime Minister is the man who said he had confidence in Mandelson in spite of what he knew. Watch this excerpt.
The ambassador has repeatedly expressed his deep regret for his association with him. He's right to do so. I have confidence in him.
He had confidence in him, and he knew, and he admitted he knew to a question sent down to him from the leader of the opposition, Kemi Badenoch. Listen to this.
Can the Prime Minister tell us, did the official security vetting he received mention Mandelson's ongoing relationship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein?
So clear. Prime Minister?
Yes, it did.
Yes, it did. The Prime Minister, the former chief prosecutor, is guilty as charged. He made the decision to appoint Peter Mandelson to be His Majesty's Ambassador Extraordinary and Plenipotentiary to the United States, in spite of reading a note provided for him that set out in clear terms that Peter Mandelson had maintained a relationship with Epstein after he had been found guilty of being a paedophile.
Okay, so there's several aspects to this, aren't there? It's quite interesting to see this information released. What it does clearly show is that Keir Starmer did lie when he said that he didn't know. He clearly did know this information. It was there before him about Mandelson's assessment, or the assessment that Mandelson had been actually to the home of Jeffrey Epstein even while he was in prison. One does wonder what he was doing there. What is he doing in Jeffrey Epstein's house in New York whilst Jeffrey Epstein himself is in prison? What is Mandelson up to over there? And the Prime Minister knew he was there. He knew he was associating. He was doing jobs for him of some sort or other. And yet he said originally, as we just heard, oh, no, I didn't know anything about it.
Well, this is obviously...
He's lying, isn't he? He's clearly lying.
Well, it's going to be a big problem for Keir Starmer, but it's also a big problem for Nigel Farage, because he thought Mandelson was the best man for the job as well. Everybody
did. You always want to just steer it onto Farage. I know you love your Labour...
just pointing out.
Your Labour people. It's nothing to do with it. Actually, it's completely separate. This is...
Farage had an opinion on Mandelson.
You're just being...
He thought he was good for the job.
You're just being obtuse, and you know you are. That Mandelson information was only privy to people in the Cabinet, right?
This Everybody knew that Epstein was a convicted paedophile.
We're talking about, yes, well, I agree. But we're talking here about the information Starmer says was in front of him. He lied.
Yes, Starmer lied, and I'm not lying when I say Farage thought Mandelson was the man for the job. I'm afraid Farage wasn't the Prime Minister.
So did many other people.
Yes.
They all say this thing at the time, but then they all go, oh, no. But the key person here is the man that made decisions, Starmer himself. Now,
that's right.
I don't know if you've heard, is it Maurice Glassman also went and did a report on this privately, went over to the United States before Mandelson was appointed and said how, it was asked to say by the civil service, by the cabinet office, to say, what do you, and the foreign office, just say, what's the, just sound out this over in America, how's it going to go down if we do appoint Mandelson? He came back to McSweeney and various other people. He's just put this out in his own little report because it all went on WhatsApp and private messages, none of them public messages, saying it's really not going to go down well if Mandelson is appointed. But McSweeney and Starmer did it anyway.
Everybody knew that Epstein was a convicted paedophile. Yeah, everybody knew. It's not secret information. He was convicted in a court, and at that point, everybody with any common sense would have gone, right, we're not having anything more to do with him. Lots of people didn't, because he was so powerful that he was... I mean, Mandelson, I think, sent him a thing, oh, we'll get you out of this. Yeah? And the same with Prince Andrew. Oh, don't worry about this, we'll sort this out for you. That's how powerful he was. Now, of course, everybody's suddenly, with hindsight, going, oh, God, we all knew this all along. Well, I tell you who didn't, Nigel Farage, because he thought Mandelson would be the good one for the job. He doesn't know much, Farage, of course. That's why he's not going to be the Prime Minister.
Well, I think he will.
I don't think he will.
Yes, he will. Why don't you? Who's going to be Prime Minister?
I mean, we don't know who's going to be the Prime Minister. Luckily, it's not going to be Starmer, it's not going to be Farage.
Luckily, Martin doesn't decide these things. The polls decide that Farage will. So, I mean, I know he's your bête noire. You just absolutely hate him. Everything is Farage's fault. Actually, he's never really been in power at all. All he's done is he's poked and prodded in order to steer the Conservative government in a more nationalist direction than it was otherwise, you know, in this one, less of a World Economic Forum style conservatism. So
but he went to the World Economic Forum. What are you on about?
Well, yes, but he's been steering the Conservative Party away from this internationalist. Yes, he's supposed to be anyway. Maybe
well,
he's not.
He's a nationalist. Well, it's going to be very interesting to see what Kenny and Farage do over the next week, isn't it? As we start getting the first British body bags.
Will we?
I think we will. That's the next thing to happen, Tony. That's the next shoe to drop.
You reckon? Why?
I think so.
I mean, the British are staying out of this, basically.
No. British RAF planes are shooting down missiles fired by the Iranians at Israel and the US. As far as the Iranian General Staff are concerned, those British Typhoons are participating in the attack on Iran. And they will be, it would be a if I was the Iranian General Staff, I'd make an absolute priority of killing some British personnel. Because the British think they're not involved, but we've got to show them that you are involved.
Well, I think you're some sort of fire starter, Martin, because surely the Iranians are thinking, well, if we don't kill any British people, then there's no excuse for them to wade in.
Well, we've already waded in. And I think they've made their position clear. And of course, they've not killed that many soldiers and airmen yet because they've been degrading the air defence on the other side. But once that is degraded, we're going to see the casualty levels massively increased by the Israelis, the Americans, and of course the British, who are all in Akrotiri in Cyprus,
I'm glad you brought that up because the British journalist Richard Medhurst, who I think is based abroad these days,
Vienna.
I'm not sure he's in Vienna, is he? Has had a really good look at exactly what the Iranians have been up to, which hasn't really been reported here at all, which is mass destruction of the radar systems, which are necessary for the missile defence, like the Patriot missiles all around the Gulf region.
So IDF says it cannot guarantee that it will send an alert for missiles before sirens sound. Right. So the Israelis went from we have the best missile defense system and you know, Arrow and Iron Dome and all of this detection. And oh, we are so smart and so great to this. IDF says it cannot guarantee that it will send an alert before missile sirens sound. And this is also reported in the Jerusalem Post. It's in all of the Israeli outlets. They also say basically that the IDF didn't specify why. Well, I think the reason is very obvious. It's because your eyes and ears have been taken out. They've been taken out by Hezbollah. Who've been hitting not just the observation posts on the blue line, which are you know, more about signals intelligence and electronic warfare, but specifically, you know, air traffic control in Ramat David Air Base in Meron as well. Those definitely are linked to the Iron Dome, and they hit also the Iron Dome radar in Haifa. So Hezbollah are actually contributing to this campaign. And also, not to mention that your main eyes and ears in the Gulf have been taken out. I mean, you know, people try to talk about Israel and the Gulf like they're two separate things, but this really goes to show you that it's not just political, but even on an infrastructure level, you know, and in terms of military cooperation, when they say military cooperation, this is what they mean. They mean they want to put radars in the Gulf countries to protect Israelis. But, you know, what does the Gulf get in return? No one really knows. The answer is nothing. You can see here also the level of censorship has gone through the roof. You've probably noticed in the last couple of days, there are no more videos coming out of Tel Aviv and of Israel, even though these strikes have ramped up. Everything I've shown you is completely 100% factual. Okay. All of this is happening now. It's happened in the last, you know, 48, 72 hours. How on earth is it that you're not seeing any footage? I collect and gather and collate and disseminate news for a living. So when I'm telling you that there's something weird going on here, there's something weird going on here. A conflict of this magnitude, it's the largest war in 20 years, right? I think we can all agree on that. It surpasses Ukraine and Russia. There should be way more footage. The Israelis have enacted now a campaign of censorship that's unbelievable. They're knocking down cameras, CCTV cameras in the street. They've always had a military censor, which is actually a British thing. They took from the British mandate, very democratic. And they've said that anyone who posts or films any of the destruction gets 5 years in prison, Israeli or otherwise. And you can see here on the news, look at CNN.
We're not showing you that because we're not going to show, the Israeli government does not allow us or want us to show where that may have come up, that interceptor, but I won't go there.
Yeah, very, very clearly. You know, they don't want you to see anything. And you know, this idea that they don't want them to see the interceptors is ridiculous. Iran knows every single inch of every interceptor, very obviously, right? I think we've proven that point, haven't we? That it's complete utter nonsense, right? And if that were the case, you wouldn't have to censor people from filming the destruction, would you? Because the destruction is you keep claiming it's arbitrary, that the Iranians are you know, barbarians and they're just hitting everywhere. Well, you don't have interceptors everywhere, do you? So why can't people film the destruction? Where is it? It's again, one of these things where they pretend like they're a democracy and everyone else is authoritarian, and it's 180 degrees, you know, the other way.
That's Richard Medhurst there, giving us a bit of insight into some of the actual damage being done by Iran, not being reported here hardly at all. In fact, in a way, you could see the potential injury of the new Ayatollah in Iran. There have been rumours also circulating about senior Israeli government people, Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu, being injured or even killed. So the news media are very interested in reporting on potential injuries to the Iranian supreme leader, but they're not in any way interested in the other way round. And I'm not sure if it's changed over the last 24 hours, but I know from the beginning of the week, Netanyahu had not appeared in public at all. So people were starting to speculate what's happened to him. Is he alive?
Well, obviously there's an enormous amount of information overload, so we've got loads of information at the same time
this is underload, isn't
that's
it?
Right, so you've got both things going on at once. Yeah, so rumors can, you know, if people using the internet can get all sorts of rumors. I mean,
surely the press here can just say something simple like, well, Netanyahu's not been seen for 4 days. We wonder if he's okay.
Well, I mean, we're speculating about it now, and people are entitled to speculate. What I've heard is that his brother has been killed. Now, I don't know, because he was in Lebanon, and of course, Hezbollah have been carrying out some pretty tasty little ambushes of the Israeli occupation forces in Lebanon, knocking out tanks and shooting them up. Even with the best will, I mean, Richard Medhurst is really good. People should check his stuff out, really. You know, obviously he was persecuted at one stage, he was arrested when he was coming through Heathrow. He's good. I mean, he's worth listening to.
He certainly is. And another person who's worth listening to is Peter Oborne. I mean, this what really bothers me about listening to the coverage that I hear all the time is there's very little, if any, reference to the fact that this was an unprovoked attack. There's no proper reference to the Iranian nuclear program and the Israeli nuclear weapons program or to international law. I mean, these are all key things as to whether a conflict is just or not, and also whether it's winnable. So the question, I mean, I think should be in the uppermost minds of London press and media is, why are they doing this? They're obviously really destroying the economy by doing it, and it doesn't seem to have any proper end in sight at all, and it's not totally unjustified. It seems to me almost like you've got a small clique that let's just call them the Epstein class, who are being found out. They're in the process of being uncovered and discovered, and this is the only thing that they can think to do is to lash out in an unprovoked war.
Well, I think there's an element of that, certainly. I mean, historians will go over it, no doubt, if we survive all of this, and try and work out the timeline by which the decisions were made and so on. It looks as if the decision to do this was when Bibi went to visit Trump just before Christmas. So this has been, and of course,
well, there was a one in February as well, actually.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I fantasize and think, well, maybe Bibi just held up a mobile phone and said, look what we've got on you, Donald.
Well, I mean, the suspicion has got to be, the stuff on the internet is that Trump was being having fellatio from a 14-year-old girl. She didn't want to do it, and he gave her a slap. That's the stuff on the internet. I don't know whether it's true, but if it is true, that's a criminal offence, and Trump should be in prison. So we avoid all of this. You see, he can be blackmailed. I mean, people like John Mearsheimer, who's a top academic, is saying, well, it could be this just blackmail on Trump. It's got this, got that, you know, because they've got stuff on him.
Newly released documents that were missing from the Epstein files contain serious unverified allegations against President Trump. The Justice Department posted three FBI memos describing interviews with a woman who accuses both Jeffrey Epstein and President Trump of sexually assaulting her when she was a teenager. The White House calls the accusations completely baseless. CNN's Paula Reed is in Washington with the latest. And Paula, these were missing from earlier file releases, right?
That's right. And this individual was interviewed by the FBI four times. And initially, only one memo was released in that initial batch of documents released by the Justice Department. And that was an interview where she made allegations against Jeffrey Epstein, but not against President Trump. Now, yesterday, these additional summaries were released, and they detail the types of allegations that she made against President Trump, where she describes being introduced to him. She alleges that he asked everyone to leave the room and, quote, mentioned something to the effect of, quote, let's teach you how little girls are supposed to be, and then describes an encounter where he pushes her head down to his penis and then told agents she bit Trump, who then allegedly struck her and said something like, get this little expletive the hell out of here. Now, in her third interview, she allegedly said that she was receiving threatening calls. And in her fourth interview, it's interesting, she told investigators that she was concerned about why she was even coming forward because the statute of limitations had passed. Now, I do want to make sure we get in here the fact that President Trump has consistently denied any wrongdoing. In a statement yesterday, the White House described these allegations as, quote, completely baseless, backed by zero credible evidence.
The U.S. Justice Department has released documents involving President Trump that had been missing, suspiciously rather, from the Epstein files. They include FBI memos from three interviews with a woman who alleges she was sexually assaulted by then-citizen Trump when she was a teenager. The president has consistently denied any wrongdoing. We should note that the inclusion of interviews in the Epstein files is not necessarily evidence of wrongdoing. It is an interview.
So it's only an interview, it's unproven, and this girl could just simply be making it up. But actually, if proven, if exposed, this could bring the president down.
Well, yes, and even the suggestion of it, I mean, people are beginning to suspect that he doesn't always tell the truth, Tony. I know it's hard for some people to get, but Donald doesn't always tell the truth.
But it's not just about that, is it? It's also about the position he's put himself in. We were talking about this woman, Jane, and a couple of weeks ago on the programme. Maybe it was even just last week. I think she's called Jane Doe. Jane's not actually her real
name.
That's right. But you can see actually what has happened here is the press in the States has done quite a good job in pressurising the Justice Department to release this stuff, which they'd only released this one which mentioned Epstein. This is all supposed to have taken when Jane was 14 and she was introduced to Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago by Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, the legal position, as I understand it, is that Massey and Rahan, I can't remember his name, is they got a vote through the Congress that all the Epstein files should be released. Not some of them, all of them. So now more have been released because the pressure's been put on. Where's the rest of the files? But in any case, not releasing all the files as originally instructed by the Congress is in fact illegal in itself. And of course, the suspicion, if you're not going to release all the files, even though you've been given an explicit instruction to do so, we are allowed to speculate what's in those files that you haven't released. And most of the people in the world who are following this will conclude that what's in those files is that Trump is in fact a sex criminal. And that's the reality of it.
Well, it's not just the United States where these sex crimes take place. So let's have a look at the UK now. And as promised, I did an interview with a woman called Sabine McNeil, who's originally born in Germany. And she was in London back in the noughties pursuing a case against the parents of two young children who said that they had been being abused as part of a sex ring in Hampstead. So this case went on and on. In fact, I even got a call from a detective asking me some questions about Sabine, which I refused to answer because I don't know where she may well have been right about it all. But anyway, she was hounded, she was persecuted, and here she explains a little bit about how she spent quite a bit of time in prison for trying to expose this Hampstead case. Now, I'd just like to stress, I'm not saying yes or no, but certainly Sabine, after spending 4 years in prison for trying to expose what had been going on here in sex abuse in London, deserves her right of reply on this. So I'm hoping that what we'll hear and what we'll see is that these rings are exposed, these abuse rings. We keep hearing, don't we, from the sort of Tommy Robinson Brigade, Martin, about grooming gangs in the north of England. Actually, John Wedger on this very programme has said actually the problem is not particularly with Muslims, but it's in London, and this is going on all the time and it's not being exposed. People like Sadiq Khan are just not doing enough, and the Met Police are not doing enough to expose it. He himself is a former Met detective, isn't he?
Well, that's right. And of course, I've just retired from working in schools, and I'm afraid abuse of children is in fact, you know, it's been going on for years. It's not some new thing that just started happening. And of course, we've got to be vigilant about it in all circumstances.
I ended up spending 4 years in prison and was deported by it, accompanied by a team of five people who looked after me just in case, because I was potentially violent, I guess. And pretty shortly afterwards, I was contacted first by New Tortoise Media and then by Story Films TV, who were apparently commissioned by Channel 4 to make a film about what they called the Hampstead hoax. But of course, they didn't convey that to me, did they? Just as the BBC, when they interviewed me when I was in Berlin before, when I was in exile for 6 months, naively, not knowing how bad the system is, how badly they need to cover up what they're covering up.
Well, look, now is your chance, if you can, in a nutshell, just sum up what you really found. If you'd had the opportunity to do that on Channel 4, what would you be saying?
That it is absolutely shameful that they sell their souls to lies and lies and lies and present it as truth. I mean, crimes are bad enough. There is an EU directive which says that clearly children should be listened to before adults, because it's a hell of a lot more likely that adults have a vested interest in covering up their crimes than that children make things up. about details. But no, the cover-ups got worse and worse and worse, from police to local family court to high court, and then to Tortoise Media, and then to Channel 4.
The press is supposed to be a sort of last court of appeal, but it seems in this case it's the opposite. The idea is it's the end of the cover-up. But for anyone that's familiar with the Hampstead case, what in a nutshell, can you just sum up what you would say in your defence?
The children. Yes, and I mean, why did I have 16,000 signatures on the petition which I addressed to the then Home Secretary, Theresa May, release the children from, I called them the whistleblower kids, and said free them or release them to their Russian family. And so 16,000 people believed the children, but the police doesn't, and the and other supporters, not me, were punished and imprisoned and put into a mental hospital. I mean, the cover-ups are worse than the crimes committed. So the system is absolutely hell-bent to cover up and not to let these crimes come out. But these children are completely precious, because they, independently of each other, as well as together, they sang this from the same hymn sheet. So they were 100% believable. And there was another petition out, which was closed after 2,000 signatures, just because the publisher didn't really look after them. But all they wanted to do is to just get the genitals investigated, which the children described. The children had made drawings. It everything was crystal clear. But no, it had to be covered up. And what is the vested interest? Why does Channel 4 need to play that game?
So there's Sabine McNeil, who was jailed for 4 years for advocating for these two children. I mean, it was a lady called Ella Draper. The Daily Mirror reported wealthy parents accused of starting a sex cult with children. And then they couch it in the terms of a wild conspiracy theory surrounding this cult was conjured up in a dark corner of the internet. Well, actually, it was testimony by these children themselves that was then parked, and it was decided through the courts that this was false testimony that they'd given. I don't think it's totally conclusive one way or the other at all. And particularly what I find suspicious is the way that everybody has just gone through from the mainstream press right the way through to Channel 4, etc., has decided that this never happened.
Well, obviously, talking about specific cases is difficult, because you need to know exactly the specific details. But I would tell a little anecdote about this. Years ago, I used to live in London, and I used to live with a guy who was a social worker. And he used to deal with child abuse cases. And most of the cases he had to deal with were in dysfunctional families in poor circumstances, etc. But it was somebody who lived not very far from where we lived on Stevendale Road in Fulham, and he was called round to their house because a small child, literally about 18 months old, had got a broken arm. So he went round to interview and they were a very posh family. I think the guy worked in the city or something like that. And he concluded that probably what had happened is that they were having some kind of a dinner party, the kid was crying, and somebody went upstairs and, you know, shook it or whatever and broke the kid's arm. So he said, well, I wasn't happy with what they were doing, so I basically flagged it up as a child abuse case. Anyway, eventually it came to court, and they got the best lawyers you could possibly imagine. And I was there giving my evidence, and he came to give his evidence that the guy was basically in the frame. And he had a whole load of people who were his best friends from school, people he worked with, you know, other people that knew him. And he got off, because people do. The wealthy get off.
Yes, in 2014, Ella Draper was embroiled in this ugly custody battle with her second husband. In July that year, her and her new man, Abraham Christie, claimed that the children had made a series of horrifying allegations regarding their father, other parents and teachers from the school. In interviews to the police, the children detailed a paedophile ring, tales of murdered babies and dark sacrifices. However, there was no evidence of the cult, and in September, the children told police they'd been pressured by Ella and Abraham to make the allegations. The investigation was then closed. Well, it may be one way or the other, who knows, but the idea that people who think one side was right and the other side was wrong should be jailed is rather worrying. And so this is why I'm sort of playing on this theme of, well, this whole Epstein class is not just something over in New York and over in Palm Beach. This sort of thing could well be going on here too. And one of the people who's spent quite a lot of time looking into this and detailing it, of course, is someone we've had on this show several times, that is a former Metropolitan Police detective who was looking into child sexual abuse in London by the name of John Wedger. But then there's also other people have been checking this out over the years, including this guy who regularly pops up on the UK column by the name of Alex Thompson. Martin, can you just say something, you know, about this whole idea of using these kids? So it's almost like a production line here, that children can be abused at a very young age and then brought up being regularly abused, actually even by their own parents. This is a sort of, you know, and then what happens is that they then bring up kids in a similar way. Is this really feasible?
Well, I mean, the fact is that there is quite, I mean, I think it's used to be about 200 kids a year are murdered by their carers in this country. I don't know what the figures are now, but of course you can imagine all the other abuse that comes up to the point where the kids actually get murdered. And of course it happens at every social level. It's and of course coming back to the Epstein case, that is not just a case of bad boys behaving badly and sexual abuse. It's also a blackmail case, which is why we've lost tens of thousands of Palestinian children who've been killed. Is that abuse? Yes, it is. And of course, that's, I'm not against having discussions about this stuff. It's important that we all understand the dangers of paedophilia and child abuse. But the particular case that everybody's focusing on now, it isn't just about that. That's what people need to remember.
Is this whole Epstein thing, is it something that's based in the States? Is it across the Atlantic?
Well, I mean, Epstein was all over the place, wasn't he? He was actually in a village up near Bradford-on-Avon, apparently. Yeah, well, that's where he was introduced to British high society. So the point of all of this, and I'm not opposed to having a general discussion about child abuse because it's a major issue, but underlying all of this, and people mustn't lose sight of this, is the blackmail of political and other leaders in the West by Mossad so that they can carry out their goals of a greater Israel and ethnically cleansing their enemies. And of course, if we die in a nuclear war, there'll be no more child abuse because there'll be no more people.
Well, what is so sort of worrying about all of this is the way that that Jimmy Savile was used by Prince Charles to write the public relations strategy for the royal family. This is very, very close.
I would suggest that Savile is definitely another case of the use of child abuse as an intelligence tool. And I think what people have got to realise is that the Western intelligence services have been using this kind of techniques for a long time. The reason they use them is that they work. You used to be able to blackmail people if they were gay and they were having, you know, disorderly sex with the same sex. You can't really do that now. But of course, if you get sent to prison as a nonce, as they call them, you have a very, very hard time. So you can blackmail people really seriously with it.
So up in Rugby, there's something called the Survivors Trust. They keep something called the Ritual Abuse Information Network and Support List. So let's have a listen now to Alex Thompson reading out some of the details from this list from the UK.
New section by Dr. Joan Coleman. New cult members, 11th of January 2006. Simon Walters, Mike Hopgood, Patricia Jones, Anne Stockton, Brian Mason, Colette Hollis, Andrew Collins, Jeanette Griffin, and Linda and John, Rochdale parents, shown on film proclaiming their innocence. New section by Dr. Joan Coleman. The following also came into the film. All names were given on the 12th of January 06. Tony Heaford, a councillor in Rochdale. Cyril Smith, a councillor in Rochdale, since died, I think. Mentioned by more than one survivor. One claimed she had been raped by him, but because she weighed so much, she was allowed to sit astride him. This, of course, is the Liberal Democrat Member of Parliament, Cyril Smith, now deceased. Elizabeth Newson, child psychiatrist, Nottingham. Also mentioned by Nottingham, involved in Broxtow cult, and by Veronica H., died in 2014. Bruce Parker, political journalist, Winchester. Jean LaFontaine. She was not mentioned in the article, but I, Dr. Joan Coleman, was in some detail. The sources, known as PALS, have seen Richard Ingram's name in the same file as those of Jean LaFontaine, Tony Baker, Bill Thompson, and Rosie Waterhouse. Ingram's, I heard later, was then seen by them at a ceremony on the 21st to 22nd of March. That's the night of the vernal equinox. Peter Mandelson, former Member of Parliament, Cabinet Minister, Member of the House of Lords, mentioned 11th of March 2006. From 2004 onwards, so at the time of the compilation of the list, he was the Commissioner for Trade. Involved in the cult in France and Brussels. Likes boys. Pays cult cash for rent boys, but seems to be a part of it. He ordered severe torture prior to the murder of a boy named Kevin, aged 17, a runaway from Newcastle, who had some hold over him and was blackmailing him. Kevin was tortured and killed. His body was dumped in the sea off the south coast of England after being cut up.
Well, that's interesting to hear Mr. Mandelson's name popping up on the Rains list there. Now, I mean, I think this is very difficult for anyone to verify this, but I mean, the Survivors Network, Martin, what it claims to do is be an open door, really, for people who believe that they are survivors of sexual abuse by paedophiles, no matter what time of their life, that this happened a long time ago, they can just go in there, they will assess them, and then if they give them names, addresses, etc., people who abuse them, they'll just simply add them to the list.
Well, I mean, it's obviously hard to comment on allegations. You know, people have got a right to be, you know, if you're going to accuse people, you've got to have some evidence. On the other hand, I'll come back to the point I made previously. The elite abuse is often connected to power plays by the elite. It isn't just having fun, inverted commas. It's to do with goals that the elite have. So the Epstein milieu was clearly created by Mossad in order to blackmail as many people as possible. And the consequences of that are this unprovoked war on Iran. That's not the only consequence, but it's a very significant consequence. And of course, if it ends in a nuclear war, it'll be a very significant consequence.
You think that's likely?
It's definitely possible. People have to understand that the Israelis have got nuclear weapons. They're about to take a huge beating. Will they just surrender, or will they get the nuclear weapons out? They ought to just surrender, but they might not.
Well, they're very unlikely to do that. I mean, as I said, we were talking about Sun Tzu, weren't we, last week? The idea is that you leave yourself no retreat.
Well, that's right. But the point is that they've got nuclear weapons, and they could nuke Iran. They could. And they might hope to get away with it, because who's going to nuke them? The Iranians, if they had nuclear weapons, could nuke them, but then they'd be killing all the Palestinians as well as the Israelis. Yeah? Whereas Iran itself is sufficiently far away from Israel that they could kill everybody in Iran and still hope to survive. Because, of course, the Russians could say, well, you're not to do that. We're going to nuke you. But then, of course, the Americans would say, well, we will nuke Russia. So you can see that there's a possibility that the Iranians, not the Iranians, the Israelis, could nuke Iran and get away with it. And quite frankly, some of the people in charge are capable of exactly that. Of course they are.
Let's stay with Sabine McNeil, though. And she's a bit of a polymath. She's a mathematical genius, really. She was one of the very first people involved in computer programming. As I said, was recruited by CERN on the, I think, isn't it, the Swiss-German border?
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly where CERN is, but, you know, this massive particle accelerator, it very much interested in maths, physics, etc., but also in human rights. Why shouldn't she be? And so I asked her about what she thought the economic consequences of this might be, and because she for many years ran something called the Forum for Stable Currencies in London, used to meet at Golden Square, and she was part of the small circle of people, generally London based, who were monetary reformers. Now, this actually, monetary reform, Martin, is quite an important little nodule, isn't it, for in any society. It's absolutely necessary if we're going to survive, surely, monetary reform.
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by monetary reform, doesn't it?
Well, there's lots of different theories. People
there,
like Hudson, who would see themselves as monetary reformers. Steve Keen, we've had on this show, Steve Hall. These people all think that the money system is basically broken and it needs to be re-engineered to serve the public rather than a financial elite.
Well, I could totally agree with that. But, of course, monetary reform can be just a kind of, oh, what we've got to do is just change the rules about money and then everything will be okay. Ultimately, this is about power.
Who creates the money? A lot of this monetary reform stuff is about that. It's also about whether it's in state hands or private hands. These are all very important questions that never get asked by mainstream press.
Well, everybody thinks that they know what money is because they've got some in their pocket, even if it's a credit card, I think the guy who used to be one
of their conveners was Austin Mitchell MP, very good Labour MP.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not opposed to monetary reform. All I would suggest to you is that monetary reform on its own is a kind of technical solution.
It's a super campaign, I think, on its own.
Yeah.
You know, well, obviously, no, they're linking up with everything else, in a way. Okay. It's an ultimate campaign.
It is.
Around capitalism. Yeah. I mean, you're a Marxist, aren't you?
Well, exactly. That, and as a Marxist, I have to tell you that... Monetary reform is a necessary but not sufficient condition. Okay, there's loads of other things you've got to do as well. Nationalise industries, win the war, all of that stuff.
It's very, very important that someone is keeping a close eye on it. Anyway, Sabine was most definitely in the 1990s and noughties in London from the Forum for Stable Currencies. But I asked her if she'd noticed any changes over in Germany with the start of this Iran war.
Today I was shocked to notice that two banks here in my little town of 25,000 people were closed. Without a sign on the door. And I hadn't noticed anything by email. And so that to me may be a sign that there's a collapse. But I deal with the problem when it comes up on one level, on another level. It depends very much who your sources of information are. I mean, it's all about a financial reset that is meant to be happening in one way or another. And who wins, the good guys or the bad guys, is I think up to nobody to predict.
So how do you think it's likely to play out? What do you think is going to happen?
Oh, I am convinced that the bad guys will lose and the good guys will win. I mean, there is no doubt about it in my mind. This is just the biggest transformation towards goodness that has to happen. I mean, I've been aware of these 2,000-year cycles for a long time and talks of the new age. And if you look into YouTube and I mean, wherever you want to look, we are just in very heavy transformational times, and people couldn't anticipate it, that it would be as people couldn't anticipate that it is as bad as it is in terms of child abuse and satanic ritual abuse and blackmailing of the elite in the West. But as people are waking up to that as the main mechanism that holds the ruling elite together, things have to change for better because they can't hide anymore. They can't go away. I just read about this. There was in Holland was a law case, a court case against Bill Gates. And so things are just happening in all sorts of levels.
You say that, but of course the international elite, banksters, the Bilderbergers, these people have been preparing for this moment for a while, haven't they? You know, if there is a collapse, they've very definitely got their system that they want to roll out.
Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe there are people who won't accept it. I cannot, and I won't imagine that they are not safe, these people, anymore. And whatever system they want to roll out, they will not be able to sell onto anybody anymore, or not everybody. Not everybody will go along anymore.
Yeah,
I mean, children are now demoing and refusing here in Germany to go to war. The people are waking up at different levels. So it's I hate to make any kind of large generalization.
Yeah, well, she's a wise lady. Look, I'm not quite sure which way this is going. I hope it goes the right way. Martin, what's your thoughts about if there is some sort of economic collapse, what's going to happen then?
Well, obviously, it's very hard to predict because it's going to be... Well, it's not hard to predict the collapse.
Isn't there a system just waiting to take over as the economies of the West start to scream, as people are thrown out of jobs, as people are thrown out of homes, etc.? There's no, you know, like the Great Depression in 1929 or whatever, a similar sort of thing. There's just not the money for people to survive, which they need every week, as we know. Then a new system will come along. But what about, for example... this idea of giving people a certain amount of money every week. Everyone in the country gets some money from the government.
Well, what you're going to find is that...
This is what they did, by the way, in Iran when they had the problems there in January. They did a handout to people.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we get into extreme circumstances, people will start discussing things like that, which they previously didn't want to talk about.
So is Rachel Reeves totally unprepared for this sort of thing then?
Absolutely. I mean, it's way above her pay grade what's happening here. I mean, and of course, that's what's happening with a lot of the conventional economists, because this is a black swan event. You know, this is why the markets have held up.
Yeah, but they say no one would ever do that, but he did.
With tensions in the Middle East pushing up global oil and gas prices again, households are understandably worried that yet another international crisis will mean higher energy bills and a higher cost of living at home. In my constituency of South Cambridgeshire, as we've heard from constituencies around the Chamber, there are many rural and semi-rural households who have to use oil for heating. And over the last week, they've seen those prices double. I've heard that the Chancellor is considering potential measures to support them. Will she support the Liberal Democrats' call for three-month zero rating for VAT on heating oil for all of those residential homes, and other measures to protect them from these just massive spikes and impact on their bills?
There's two things going on in terms of heating oil. First of all, you've got the conflict in the Middle East, which we're trying to de-escalate. And second, you've got price gouging. And the way to deal with that is to ensure that customers are treated fairly and that companies are not ripping off their customers. That is why we've asked the CMA to look at the issues around heating oil. But we've got to get to the root of the problem, which is that vessels aren't flowing through the Straits of Hormuz, and some businesses are using this crisis as an opportunity to rip off consumers. Let's deal with that rather than throwing public money at something which is not the solution. Price gouging and getting oil flowing is.
Well, hang on, because these energy companies were ripping off consumers long before the Straits of Hormuz were closed, but at least it's good to hear her saying that.
Well, it's also a diversion, because they can't do anything about the war, really. It's beyond their control. But they can sound as if they're doing something by saying that we're going to lean on the energy companies to keep their prices down, because they're not popular and we can have a go at them. All energy companies should be publicly owned. British Petroleum used to be publicly owned. It was set up by the British government to ensure a good supply of oil for the Royal Navy so that we could win world wars. And of course, a major piece of that jigsaw was controlling the oil in Iran, which we did until 1954, when the democratic government of Iran tried to nationalise it.
Well, we're gonna have,
and then we saw that their legs broken.
We're going to have listen to Donald Trump and Nigel Farage now. Martin, who would you prefer? Let's start with Farage here. And he's asked here what he thinks about the war, whether he supports it or not.
Given that we can't even send a raw naval vessel to defend British sovereign territory and an RAF base, we certainly don't have the capability to offer anything of any value to the Americans or the Israelis. So defending the base, recognising the catastrophe that is now the Royal Navy, and by the way, President Macron is really, frankly, showing the humiliating state that we've sunk to today with his very decisive actions and his intention to help clear the Straits of Hormuz. And the other point is protecting British citizens. I think so far the government have hired one charter plane, and even that broke down and was 24 hours late. So yes, we should never, ever, ever have said no to the Americans using the bases, particularly Diego Garcia. And interestingly, Mauritius have been very, very clear. They would not have allowed that base to be used at all. So there are differing opinions as to whether we should physically join the attacks. I, as leader, am saying to you, if we can't even defend Cyprus, let's not get ourselves involved in another foreign war.
My question then is, what is Reform's position? Because you two have said...
I've just told you what the position is. We cannot get involved directly in another foreign war. We don't have a navy. We can't even defend our own military base in Cyprus.
Well, I mean, isn't that an interestingly contradictory set of statements?
Well, he's being very slippery. He's saying, well, we want to keep out of this because our navy isn't good enough, but we're quite happy to let the Americans use our bases.
Yes. So in other words, if the Americans are using our bases, we've not kept out of it, have we? And he's also not, of course, not addressing the fundamental question, is why have we got a base in Cyprus? Because in actual fact, Cyprus doesn't want that base to be there. And in actual fact, they went to war against us in the 1950s. General Grivas killed loads of British soldiers to get the British
just
out of Cyprus.
Focus on the actual
whether or not
Farage is behind and his party are behind what the Americans are doing. He seems to be hinting, yes, they are, but we'd rather not get involved because the British Armed Forces are not equipped to do so.
Well, that's a kind of weaselly way of saying I want to spend loads more money on the military because I think that's what I want to do, but we haven't got any. And we're not involved, even though they're using our bases. And as he pointed out,
but it
Mauritius
might also be another way.
They could, if we had that, but Diego Garcia is British territory. He's right, and the Americans shouldn't have a base on it. They shouldn't have a base in Fairford either. They're bombing civilians from Fairford as we speak. Maybe somebody should go up there and start a bit of killing.
Well, there was actually a demonstration up there of peace groups, Martin. I mean, maybe if you could go up there maybe on your own and
do a suicide bomb.
Yeah, something silly. Yeah. But actually, the peace groups, thank God, are the ones who are actually doing something rather than you with your talk. Because, I mean, none of this really is you know, what you're being is just provocative. I was trying to get to the point there about Farage and Reform's position because, in a way, what they're trying to do is to play to their voters. They're saying, well, look, we can be nationalistic here and we can say, no, we're going to stand up to the Americans. You know, we're not going to get involved here. But he doesn't seem to want to actually really go that far. And so instead he's saying, oh, well, our armed forces are rubbish, so we can't do anything. So he's being quite sneaky. Reform seem to be getting closer and closer to the Israel lobby, actually, in this country.
Well, they are. They are paid by the Israel lobby. I mean,
is that because they are number one in the polls at the moment?
Well, no, the Israelis will try and bribe them.
They've been courting them.
Yes,
maybe,
of course they have. And of course he went to that...
They're not nationalistic at all, really. They're an Israeli party.
No, that is right,
they're
Tony.
Not a British party.
No.
So they should be waving their Israeli flag, shouldn't
well,
they?
When we had the right-wing turn up to our anti-war protest last week in Bristol, they were waving American and Israeli flags. Because that is, in fact, who runs this country. That's who's been running this country since 1945. It's time for a bit of liberation.
Anyway, at least the Royal Navy has managed to send this HMS Dragon, which is a hideous-looking machine. I mean, it's all sort of square and it's got these, you know, flat space. It looks horrible, but apparently it's really cool and it's got loads of missiles that can defend Cyprus.
Now here we are in Portsmouth Harbour. We've got the Millennium. Behind it, we've got HMS Victory. We've got HMS Warrior, the first ironclad. And these make us think back to days when Portsmouth was an incredible, proud place. And by the way, it's still proud. I just met a mum whose son is on HMS Dragon, which you can see there in the distance. That is setting sail in about an hour's time. But it would have taken us a fortnight, to get one naval vessel from Portsmouth to defend British sovereign territory in Cyprus. 2 points here. Number one, the sheer indecision and hopelessness of Keir Starmer as a leader. And number two, the rundown of our Navy during 14 years of Conservative rule. And the problem with this, it isn't just that we're defenceless, it's the rest of the world is losing respect for us. And it was from places like Portsmouth that we became the greatest nation the world has ever seen. If this moment is not a turnaround, if this moment is not a wake-up call that says we must do something, I don't know what is.
Well, he's trying to have it both ways there, isn't he? We shouldn't allow our bases to be used by the Americans to bomb schools with children in. No, that would be bad. But we are going to defend our sovereign base on Cyprus. The government in Cyprus doesn't want that base there. There are massive demonstrations going about.
Farage has just corrected you, because Farage is saying our air bases should be used by the Americans.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, we are involved. And I tell you what will be interesting, if that ship is sunk and everybody gets killed, what's he going to do? He said it was good to send them.
Yeah.
I think we should just get out of the war. We shouldn't be sending any more troops. We should say
don't
to
you,
the
don't you think the British servicemen in women in Cyprus would rather have that ship floating around with its little missile systems in order to stop incoming drones and things?
Yes, but the people in Hezbollah who have taken hundreds of casualties, civilian casualties in the last week, are going to say, you're our enemy, and you are all volunteer soldiers. The people you've been killing are first responder teams. Yeah, they're women and children. Everybody on the base in Cyprus or on the ship is a volunteer soldier or sailor.
Well, it is.
Therefore, you're a legitimate target in World War III.
True,
of course you are.
The United States and Israel have been deliberately targeting first responders, particularly fire stations, this sort of thing. And, of course, by killing the police and police stations, what you're doing then is stopping the Iranians trying to control foreign agents who are operating as rioters and terrorists on the ground in Iran.
Well, as you saw last week, the Israelis attacked the an oil refinery near Tehran, which caused massive acid, huge pollution, dangerous pollution to the population. That's a deliberate attack on civilian infrastructure. And, of course, the Iranians at a certain point will knock out all the other countries that are fighting against them, their civilian infrastructure. And, of course, if Russia comes into the war, Portsmouth, which he's talking about there, will be a major target, and it won't kill any civilians. They'll put it on the naval base, and they'll go for hundreds and hundreds of British military casualties. And then, of course, we'll say we can raise taxes to have a fight against the Russians. Oh, we can't raise the taxes because, the banks have collapsed, and we've got no money.
So let's have a listen now to the US President Donald Trump, who started this whole thing with his pal Netanyahu a couple of weeks ago.
The situation with Iran is moving along very rapidly. It's doing very well. Our military is unsurpassed. There's never been anything like it. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. And we're doing what has to be done, should have been done during a 47-year period. Could have been done by a lot of different people. They chose not to do it. But they really are a nation of terror and hate, and they're paying a big price right now.
Iran is a nation of terror and hate. Actually, if you try and take a step back from this, maybe look from the moon, anyone would look at the United States as a nation of terror and hate. Now, the ordinary American citizens are not like that, but they have a government, don't they, that seems to think it can march into any country, take it over, kill the leaders, and replace them with their mates.
Well, yes, but of course, it's actually the other thing about it is that it's not going to work. They used to be able to do that after 2001 and the 9/11 attacks, which everybody who looks into them knows very well, was carried out by the US deep state and Mossad. I'm quite sure the Russians know that, and the Chinese, and loads of people around the world.
Lots of Americans know it too.
Well, indeed.
I hate to break it to you.
That's right.
And Brits, us.
So in other words, this whole thing has been brewing for over 20 years, and we've now arrived at the decisive moment.
This is a yin-on-plan moment, isn't it? The greater Israel, the idea is we're going to expand Israel to such an extent that we can dominate the Middle East, dominate the centre of the planet, and then dominate the world.
That's right, but unfortunately, from a military point of view, they've completely misjudged the situation.
Haven't they sort of blown it all by actually revealing what they're up to beforehand?
Well, I mean, most people are, you can reveal it, but most people are frankly, anaesthetised. It's been obvious what the Israelis have been wanting to do for ages and ages and ages and ages and ages, but somebody should tell Julia Hartley Brewer, who we had on earlier. Because she thinks
Are they really hoping that they can get away with this by having a bunch of Julia Hartley Brewers on the ends of cameras and microphones in this privately owned transmitter broadcasting systems? They know that this is all they can do with this propaganda is get through a few measures. But they're not going to be able to win using this by bamboozling their own people.
No, they're not. I mean, but don't forget that during the Ukraine war, all the obsession with PR... Like the ghosts of Kiev, you know, this so-called mythical pilot who was shooting down all the incoming Russian stuff. But it was all just made up. And it was paid for, you know, these people are propagandists. And, of course, the problem is it becomes a self-reinforcing cycle. So when you tell the propaganda to the masses that this is what we're doing, we're standing up to the evil Iranians and the poor Israelis are under attack, blah, 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 You then start believing your own propaganda. And the reality is Iran has got modern hypersonic missiles and the British military have not, because we've privatised our whole structure for anything like that, and it's too late now. That ship, right, is absolutely a target for an Iranian missile, and they won't be able to fire back because it'll come from hundreds of miles away and it will just hit the ship amidships and they'll all drown.
Well, the advent of social media has meant that almost anyone can have their say on all this, and although these views which are supporting Iran are very, very few and far between at all on our mainstream press right across the UK, in fact, there's no mention of the facts, really very little or any mention of the fact that this is an unprovoked and illegal. It's amazing how a war can just sort of happen, and suddenly it's almost like a new advertising campaign for a kind of chocolate or something. It's suddenly the big thing. Everyone's talking about it, but there's no questioning of the fundamentals. So people are coming out with little comments like this, as this lady from the north of England did.
Come on, Iran, get the job done. Keep at it and at it, you know, if you haven't got enough money for the missiles. I'm willing to chip in a bit. I've got a few quids going spare. I don't mind helping you. Come on, get the job done. Keep at it. Keep at it. Flatten it. You know what I'm talking about. Flatten it. Like Gaza was flattened. You get that job done. You get it done, kidder. Sort the buggers out. Teach them a bloody lesson. Yeah, I'm with you, Iran. You sort them out.
So this is a general, ordinary sentiment, isn't it? Mm. The Iranians are doing actually what we should have been doing, which is to actually put it back in their box, these genocidalists.
Well, that's right. We went to war with Serbia because of the Rakac massacre, supposedly, which actually subsequently turned out to be a bit of a fraud. But, of course, we were told at the time that the Serbian security forces were carrying out mass murder of Kosovan civilians, and therefore we had to go to war with them. Not just put sanctions on them. They'd had sanctions on them since 1991, but go to war with them. Bomb them. Bomb their TV stations and kill their weather girls. And we did. 78-day war. But
Is the lady right? I mean, it's saying go on, flatten them, flatten them. You're never going to flatten Israel. I mean, it really frustrates me that people seem to think, oh, well, we can just win this, you know. No, the Israelis have got nuclear weapons, and it seems to me inevitable that if Israel is taken to the point where the government is destroyed, the sort of things they're trying to do to Iran, then of course they're going to use their nukes, aren't they?
Well, that's why the Iranians are going very steady on all of this. They're causing them pain, but they're causing them pain over a long period. What is really, really going to do for the West here is the Iranians are prepared to fight for up to 5 years here, and they're talking about 5 days, 5 weeks, up to September. But they're going to fight. Once their defence has been knocked down, which the Iranians have done, they can just hit anything they want at any time, anywhere, including Dragon ship. Yeah, I'm quite sure they can probably hit that in the Mediterranean, and they'll have an accurate missile that will land straight on top of it. And of course, you won't be able to fire back because you can't.
There's also a lot of misinformation out there. When a bomb goes off on a Saudi oil refinery or an oil storage plant, it's assumed that Iran is doing this. Iran, Martin, is saying they're not. So let's have a listen now to Mohamed Mirandi speaking on Channel 4 News again this week, talking about that sort of incident and generally about the Iranian attitude to Donald Trump.
Iran has not taken any responsibility for the strikes on the energy facilities, for example, in Saudi Arabia. That could be something carried out by the Israeli regime. But the Iranians have told tankers that they are not allowed to leave the Strait of Hormuz. And when these Arab regimes in the Persian Gulf, when they give the United States military bases to use against Iran, then there are consequences. They cannot have their cake and eat it too. They cannot participate in aggression against Iran alongside this Epstein coalition and then sit back and say we're neutral.
Right, but you're not denying the other attacks, are you, in other Gulf countries which do affect energy supplies, and the oil price has gone up significantly. So I mean, that does seem to be part of the Iranian military strategy, isn't it? I mean, to try and bring them into the war and regionalize it.
No, Iran has been targeting U.S. assets in the Persian Gulf, and those assets could be anything that's linked to the United States. The United States is bombing hospitals. The United States is bombing schools. The United States is bombing Iranian national radio and television alongside the Israeli regime. So U.S. assets in the Persian Gulf, they too will be attacked. But assets that belong to the states in the Persian Gulf region, they have not been touched by the Iranians. However, if they host U.S. forces, because many of the soldiers have left their bases and been taken to hotels, the Iranians will target them. So at the end of the day, if they want this problem to end, they have to expel soldiers of the Epstein regime.
Now, we understand that the Assembly of Experts is trying to appoint a new supreme leader. Could a new leader, do you think, negotiate with Trump and agree to his terms?
No. Iran is not interested in negotiating with Trump or the U.S. regime. Iran is going to punish the United States. And we are in the process of doing it. This regime in Washington has tried to cross a bridge that's a bridge too far. And they're messing with the wrong country. We're not Venezuela. We're not Iraq. We're not Libya. We're not Afghanistan. And we're not Syria. This is the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we will make sure that the United States regrets the aggression against the Iranian people and the slaughter of children, and the slaughter of innocent civilians, and the murder of the leader. These are crimes against humanity, and the United States and its allies have imposed the law of the jungle upon the world, and they will come to regret it.
The United States is a very powerful military force, more powerful than Iran. But so do you think those are empty words where he's saying that they've gone too far, a bridge too far, which that's a great film, by the way. Is he right?
Well, I mean, they could always, both the US and the Israelis could get out their nuclear weapons and nuke Iran. Short of that, he is right, because Iran is fighting a defensive battle on its own turf that it's prepared for years. And don't forget, they had 8 years of war against Iraq. So their military is absolutely battle
but they
harder.
Have had, they've had a decade or so more of sanctions against them. So how on earth can they build up any kind of ability to respond militarily?
Well, when you've got sanctions on you, as we've got sanctions on Russia, you have to do it's Sinn Féin, ourselves alone, Tony.
But actually, it's not quite that, Martin. It's not quite. I mean, what happens is you start doing deals through neutral states or through, like Turkey, for example. We'll be saying, OK, we'll get a hold of those for you. It's going to be a bit of a markup, but you can have them.
What nuclear weapons?
No, we're talking about whatever they need.
Turks aren't going to supply anything to them because they're in NATO.
What the sanctions? Well, hang on, because that's one of the things I've been hearing is that there are Turkish businesses who are selling, who are brokering. So when the Iranians want something, that they will get it through neutral countries, and that they will funnel it through. They'll have to pay a bit more for it, whatever it is. But the sanction, this is something which is fairly easy actually to get round once you've decided you do. I mean, you and I have been sanctioned. We're not allowed to work for Russia. We're not allowed to get paid anyway for working for Russian press anymore.
Well, I mean, sanctions lead over time to a situation where the Iranians have developed their own military industry based on their own stuff that they have done themselves. So they have got some cooperation from the Russians and from the Chinese. The Chinese have got a spy ship there, which is really helping them. But in actual fact, they've got their own hypersonic missiles, which are far superior to anything the British Royal Navy or the Americans have got.
If the Chinese are helping the Iranians, why don't the Americans sink the Chinese ship?
Because then it'll be nuclear war, Tony. So there's always a game of bluff going on here.
Well, they could say they did it by accident, can't
they? Well, they can, and then we can say that all your aircraft carrier has been sunk by our Chinese submarine, and that was an accident. Yeah, accidents can happen to everybody.
Hmm. Well, anyway, let's have one of the most recent, it's in Ohio, interviews with Donald Trump to see how he thinks the war, his war of aggression, his ultimate war crime, from the president who said he was going to stop World War III and then decided to start it.
Incredible. Our military is unbelievable, the job they're doing. I would say, to put it mildly, way ahead of schedule. We've knocked out their Navy, their military in all forms. We've knocked out just about everything there is, including their leadership. Twice. We knocked out twice their leadership. And now they have a new group coming up. Let's see what happens to them. But 47 bad years we suffered with them, not only us, the rest of the world. We're doing our job. So we had to take an excursion, but it's doing well. The market's holding up well. I figured we'd be hit a little bit, but we were hit probably less than I thought, and we'll be back on track in a pretty short while. Prices are coming down very substantially. Oil will be coming down. That's just a matter of war that happens very, you can almost predict it. I would say it went up a little bit less than we thought. It's going to come down more than anybody understands. Do you have any questions, Peter?
Yes. You just said it is a little excursion, and you said it is a war. So which one is it?
Well, it's both. It's both. It's an excursion that will keep us out of a war, and the war is going to be... for them, it's a war. For us, it's turned out to be easier than we thought. But think of it, they had thousands of missiles, 7,000-8,000 missiles. We got many of them before they got to launch. They have drones all over the place. We got many. Now we're knocking out the drone plants, as you know, going fast. They started talking about mines, so we hit 28 mine ships as of this moment, 28, using the same weapon, the exact same weapon that we use against the drug dealers in the water. We have... as an example, we had tremendous drugs pouring in through the water, through the sea, and now we have almost none. It's down 97% through water. Now we'll do it through land. Land is easier than water.
So it's both a war and an excursion. He's rambling on there about the comparison between sinking the mine-laying ships of the Iranians with sinking the Venezuelan fishing boats. So this is what the American forces are up to now. But, I mean, he sounds as if he's just going to carry on doing this, isn't he?
Well, he wants it to be over and him to win. But, of course, you can want anything, but you can't necessarily have it, because reality ain't like that.
Is he deluded?
Yes.
He just sounds,
I mean,
like,
yeah, of course he is. I mean, if I was in the US military, I would be, you know, I'd be absolutely horrified to have somebody like that in charge. I mean, if you're in the Russian military, on the other hand, they're quite keen to have Putin in charge and Gerasimov. They clearly know what they're doing. Hegseth and Trump, not so much.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. 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 What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know? Don't you mind about the future? Don't you try to think ahead. Save tomorrow for tomorrow. Think about today instead.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz?
I could give you facts and figures.
What's the buzz?
Even give you plans and forecasts. Even tell you where I'm going.
When do we ride to Jerusalem? When do we ride to Jerusalem? When do we ride to Jerusalem?
Why should you want to know? Why are you obsessed with fighting? Times and fates you can't defy. If you knew the path we're riding, you'd understand it less
what's
than I.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Let me try to cool down this bit. Let me try to cool down this bit. Let me try to cool down this bit. Let me try to cool down this. Let me try. Let me try to cool down this. Let me try to cool down this bit.
That is good while you prattle through your supper. Where and when and who and how. She alone has tried to give me what I need right here now.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. 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 What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
We got
a switch. Oh, the nuclear will go for me.
The land that I live in has God on its side. Oh, the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charge, the Indians fell. The cavalry's charged, the Indians died. Oh, the country was young with God on its side. The Spanish American War had its day, and the Civil War too was soon laid away, and the names of the heroes I was made to memorize, with guns in their hands and God on their side. The First World War, boys, it came and it went. The reason for fighting I never did get, but I learned to accept it with pride. For you don't count the dead when God's on your side. the Second World War came to an end. We forgave the Germans, and then we were friends. Though they murdered 6 million in the ovens they fried, the Germans now to have God on their side. I learned to hate the Russians all through my whole life. If another war comes, it's them we must fight. To hate them and fear them, to run and to hide, and accept it all bravely with God on my side. But now we got weapons of chemical dust. If I them were forced to, then fire them we must. One push of the button, they shot the world wide. And you never ask questions when God's on your side. Through many dark hours, I've been thinking about this, that Jesus Christ was betrayed by a kiss. But I can't think for you, you'll have to decide whether Judas Iscariot had God on his side. So now as I'm leaving, I'm weary as hell. The confusion I'm feeling, ain't no tongue can tell. The words fill my head and fall to the floor. That if God's on our side, he'll stop the next war.
'64, that's God on our side. From Bob Dylan. Which album, Martin? I'm sure you know these things.
Freewheeling.
No, it's not. No, no, no.
Oh, no, no, it's not.
Blowing in the Wind, I think it's
not. No, that's not Freewheeling. No. It's the... Ooh.
Come on, someone. I'm sure Bob someone Dylan out there knows. Yeah. But anyway, it's it was 1964, that one. And just the year after, I think we heard last week's Dylan contribution, which was... about World War III and about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Anyway, he seems to be the man of the moment. He still is. He's not actually really anywhere in the press, the news. He's one of those people who's an absolutely brilliant, interesting, fascinating character, a bit of a genius, and he's been cancelled, I reckon. You don't hear anything much about him, even though, of course, he would have all sorts of interesting things to say about this, and he's probably still doing songs about the whole crazy situation. Before that, of course, we had Fun Boy 3. The Lunatics have taken over. What a marvellous little song that is. It's just so brilliant. You know, a bit of a prophet, old Terry Hall. And The Carpet Crawl, we heard from Seconds Out, Genesis, one of the first albums I ever bought when I was a kid. That's, I think, a lovely song, a sort of introspection, about introspection. Come on, Trump, a bit of introspection, mate. And at the very, very beginning, from the Jesus Christ Superstar from 73, that was What's the Buzz? Anyway, welcome back to the Bristol Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. I think we'll probably start, Martin, by listening to one of the best. I mean, I found Peter Oborne to be, I know I keep going about Double Down News, but one of the best commentators on all this. Are there any others that you'd like to mention? Because there's been some, you know, Peter's originally from the Daily Telegraph and Daily Mail. He was writing for the Daily Mail and one of their chief correspondents, but you know, he's just telling it like it is, and there doesn't seem to be anywhere for these people to go apart from places like Double Down News these days.
Well, that's right. I mean, he was a conventional mainstream right-of-centre journalist, and he's been on a bit of a path, a bit of a...
I remember meeting around the time of 7/7. There was some kind of meeting in London a couple of years after, and had a chat with Peter Oborne. It was to do with the Islamophobia that had come out of 7/7. That was the theme of the meeting. And he was a fascinating guy to talk about. He was absolutely... I remember I was talking about some of the stuff that we'd been digging out about the security service involvement, about Netanyahu's involvement. And there he was, like any decent journalist does, sitting there scribbling away. So, you know, if you're a good journalist, you've got your notebook there. If someone's telling you something, you scribble it away. You can check it out. It's either rubbish, it's not. And you can then tell everyone else, because that's what journalists are supposed to do. Only the mainstream press doesn't seem to bother. What is it about the mainstream press, Martin, that is so toxic?
Money.
Not the BBC.
Well, in that case, it's just the state telling you what to think, isn't it?
Why?
Because a lot of what goes on is designed to get you to do stuff. I mean, presumably, I suppose, in our own little way, we're trying to get people to do stuff.
No, we're not, no. I'm not interested in that at all. What I'm interested in doing is understanding what's going on, predicting maybe what might be happening next week, and understanding what the real motives are. So that, to me, is the interest in doing what we do. Is, I mean, maybe you and I have got different ways of looking at it, but it is to pick through the lies, to see through the subterfuge, because so much of what we're getting, particularly with the all the shenanigans in the Middle East over the last decade or so, with the terrorism, domestic terrorism here, is subterfuge.
Well, that's right. I mean, we're basically increasingly, more than ever, in a dystopian world in which a lot of, as I was saying earlier in the show, we're overwhelmed with information which is designed to bewilder us. And then, of course, we can then have suggestions planted in our minds after the bewildering has taken place.
And the thing I love about Peter Oborne is he's also looking at all these questions around Farage. Everyone should be, of course, scoping the people who are set to be the next leaders in Britain, the reform. If there's another general election, that's at least how it would shape out on the current polls. He's checking out them too. What are they saying? What are they thinking? So over to Alexa from this week's report by Peter Oborne, which I think is one of the best I've seen so far anywhere about the Iran war.
It's clear that we face the likelihood of a global recession as oil prices spiral. We'll have some kind of civil war in Iran, and that will lead to millions of refugees fleeing for their lives. They'll come to the West, and then, of course, Nigel Farage, who's been one of the keenest advocates of this folly, will then start to protest about more boat people.
I'm normally incredibly nervous about intervening in foreign wars. I believe this is the right one.
And I find the actions of our Prime Minister, or the inactions, perhaps I should say, of our Prime Minister, frankly pathetic.
What you have here is a very strange phenomenon whereby the Brexiteers, who decided that they were going to fight for British freedom, are absolutely delighted to take the side of a foreign power which has been sponsoring what most people regard as a genocide in Gaza, and is now conducting a completely illegal war in Iran. They're taking the side of that foreign leader, deeply implicated in Epstein, against a British Prime Minister who's not going far enough in his blind support for an illegal war of aggression. Now let's turn to the way that Iran is presented as a nuclear threat.
If we didn't hit within 2 weeks, they would have had a nuclear weapon.
This line has been peddled by Benjamin Netanyahu for two or three decades now.
If Iran acquires a nuclear bomb, it could use any one of these shadowy groups to threaten the United States, threaten the West.
Time is running out.
They're very close. They're 6 months away from being about 90% of having the enriched uranium for an atom bomb.
By next summer, at current enrichment rates, they will have finished the medium enrichment and move on to the final stage. From there, it's only a few months, possibly a few weeks. Weeks away from having the fissile material for an entire arsenal of nuclear bombs.
They have the wherewithal, the stored up preserved knowledge to make a bomb very quickly.
If not stopped, Iran could produce a nuclear weapon in a very short time. It could be a year, it could be within a few months, less than a year.
There's no evidence of this, and there never has been any serious evidence of it. And yet, constantly, and now in this conflict, Iran is presented as the nuclear risk. They don't point out that Israel has something like 200 nuclear weapons. Nobody knows for sure, because they can't be inspected, because they refuse to put themselves under international regulation, like every other country which has nuclear weapons. To give one small example of this and how the media collaborates with the creation of this false picture, a little while before Israel launched its attack on Iran, there was a very significant earthquake near Dimona, which is an Israeli nuclear plant. It would have been perfectly reasonable to speculate, has Israel carried out a nuclear test? But by reading the British or American papers, you would never have the faintest idea about that. Whereas we've had repeated assertions, amplified in the media, that Iran was on the edge of producing nuclear weapons. Well, there's no evidence that this is the case, and even Donald Trump can't think so, because he said their nuclear presence was absolutely wiped out a few months ago.
As you know, their sites were obliterated. They're very evil nuclear sites. They were, now has been proven. And we took out two of the other sites also. In addition to that, we finished them off. But I don't believe that they're going to go back into nuclear anytime soon. It's been obliterated. It would be years before they could ever get going.
The media are murtered about Israel's possession of nuclear weapons. Especially curious when it comes from the Times newspaper, which, after all, broke the story that Mordecai Vananu, who was part of the nuclear program, was blowing the whistle on it. So they know perfectly well what the situation really is, but you hardly ever get serious references to the fact that the real nuclear power, unregulated, with nobody trying to exert control of them, is Israel and not Iran. Nor have I seen a single reference to the fact that Ayatollah Khamenei was doctrinally opposed to nuclear weapons. He issued a fatwa against the possession of nuclear weapons. The Islamic Republic of Iran considers the use of nuclear, chemical, and similar weapons as a great and unforgivable sin. That came from Iran's supreme leader. There's a paradox here. Israel, America, assassinated a leading opponent of nuclear weapons. It is worth remembering as well that Iran's civil nuclear program was developed with American encouragement and support under the late Shah of Iran. After the revolution, the Iranians put it on hold. They did seek to get nuclear weapons, and the nuclear claims made against Iran only evolved after George W. Bush made his announcement about the so-called axis of evil. The claims made against Iran over nuclear weapons have routinely been fabricated in order to produce an excuse to destroy the country. It's exactly the same technique which was used against Saddam Hussein in order to give an excuse for Tony Blair and George W. Bush to invade Iraq in 2003. Israel and America knew perfectly well, whatever they claimed publicly, that Iran was nowhere near getting hold of nuclear weapons. And that tells you something, that their primary motive for this attack was not to stop Iran's nuclear weapons, whatever you may read in the newspapers. It was the attempt to maliciously destroy the Iranian state and replace it by what is most likely to be total chaos. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Sir Richard Dearlove, the former head of MI6, has popped up.
We should have been clear-cut from day one and supported the Americans and the Israelis unequivocally.
Sir Richard Dearlove was the head of MI6, responsible for the production of fabricated information suggesting that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, which enabled Britain and America to claim some kind of spurious and fake legality for their invasion of Iraq.
Well, that's just an excerpt from that piece. I think it's about 15 minutes long by Peter Oborne. It's just, you know, he does the job of journalism properly, does it well. He's teasing out some of the key points which are being missed by other journalists, supposed journalists, propagandists in the mass media. And he finishes off rather nicely there with this point about Richard Dearlove, who, of course, was the man behind the dodgy dossier and MI6. No one's elected them.
No. And it's good to see people like Oborne, who started off as, you know, fairly conventional Tory journalists, because that's the kind of people they employ at the Telegraph. And, you know, he's allowed himself to be influenced by the facts, and that is all to the good.
Well, great, making some great points about Farage as well. Does he not, if he wants to encourage this war, does he want loads more people to arrive on boats?
Well, it's a pretty obvious point to make, isn't it? We've been destroying all sorts of countries that are much closer to us than they are to the United States for the last 20 years. And then, of course, there's consequences that flow from that, obviously.
He has quite a few clips of Netanyahu there at different points of history, talking about how the Iranians are building this nuclear weapon. I mean, of course, Netanyahu could be right. They could be planning to do that. And they are actually now this CND-style anti-nuclear weapon Ayatollah has been killed. Maybe the new guy is going to say, well, that's okay, come on, let's just go for it, we may as well, otherwise they're going to nuke us and kill us all, and they're trying to destroy us, and so we need to have a nuclear weapon potentially.
Well, there is a strong case for Iran to have nuclear weapons, far stronger than for us to have them. We're never going to use them except when in a general conflagration. Yeah, the Americans, we're under their nuclear umbrella. And
we can't actually use our nuclear weapons.
Without the Americans anyway.
I'm not sure if we've got free-fall nuclear bombs that we could drop from aircraft, which might work. But one thing's for sure, the Trident ballistic missile delivery system is we have to doff our cap and beg the Americans if we want to use that, because they can just switch it off if they want to.
Well, that's right. So in other words, a country like Britain, and there are plenty of other countries in Europe, let's just take it for example, Spain, doesn't have nuclear weapons because you don't need them. Iran, on the other hand, there's a strong case for them to have nuclear weapons, but they've decided not to for their own reasons. And that's not least because, A, they think they're immoral, and B, they don't necessarily need them because they can devastate. Israel's quite a small place, and they can be pretty seriously messed up with conventional weaponry. They've got desalination plants which provide most of the drinking water. Once those are knocked out, you can only live 3 days without water. That means the whole population just dies of thirst.
But you can understand why the Israelis feel threatened, surely. I mean, surrounded by these Arab and Persian countries that none of whom recognise Israel, many of whom want Israel not to exist.
Well, that's right. And, of course, all of these Gulf states, which are the family dictatorships, they were created artificially by the West. And in actual fact, at the end of World War III, some states will exist and other states will not. There may be no state of Saudi Arabia at the end of World War III, and there may be no state of Israel either.
So I think we need to hear a little bit from, and we've heard a bit of Peter Oborne's propaganda, even though I wouldn't really call it propaganda. It's just a very rare bit of proper journalism. So instead of that, let's hear from Benjamin Netanyahu now, explaining why we should be so afraid of Iran and why the Americans and the Israelis are doing a great job trying to destroy the country.
They take away the Soviet Union and its chief proxy, the PLO. International terrorism would collapse.
If you take out Saddam's regime, I guarantee you that it will have enormous positive reverberations on the region. Third nation, by the way, is Libya. Obviously, we'd like to see a regime change, at least I would, and Iran exporting terrorism not only to every part of the Middle East, but to Venezuela.
By the way, what are we doing with Greenland? We got to do something with Greenland.
You have to wash their brains and tell them there's a higher cause out there. It's religious, ethnic, racial, whatever. And for that higher cause, you can disregard all the normal rules of morality.
And it's interesting, isn't it? He's actually openly there talking, Netanyahu, about brainwashing people.
Well, what he said at the end there, when you've got a higher cause, it's bigger than morality. So, oh, hang on a minute. What higher cause is bigger than morality?
Well, the idea that Israel may be wiped out, that's a higher cause, isn't it?
Well, but that might be a higher cause, but why is that beyond morality? The attitude is that we have a right to everything we want and other people are expendable. That is a quite literally fascistic notion, isn't it?
But he's being open about it there, talking about one by one these various countries which are a terrible threat to us, and they are one by one they're being wiped out, aren't they?
Well, they are being wiped out because what the Israelis in
Iraq, Libya, Syria.
Yes, Afghanistan. And, of course, we invaded Afghanistan. We invaded Afghanistan in Britain because of the 9/11 attacks. And all the evidence shows that the 9/11 attacks, as Trump himself said, because he was a New York property developer who used to build skyscrapers. At the time, he said, skyscrapers don't collapse like that. He came out and said it, and he was right, because they don't. The buildings were bombed, and if they were bombed, it wasn't carried out by Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, in any case, is a Western cat's paw. We've just put Al-Qaeda in power in Syria, and the Syrian army is massing on the Lebanese border as we speak to fight with Hezbollah. Al-Qaeda and Israel are the same.
Well,
many
people do. It's just except it seems to take a long time to get through to mainstream press journalists, other than people on the fringes and on the outside, like Peter Oborne. There has been, though, the United Nations has been trying, not doing very well this week in actually passing resolutions, and they've only managed to pass one, which is condemning Iran. Now, I just find, I mean, is the UN just a useless body? Because I'll just play the report and you can comment after we've heard from Al Jazeera.
Will those in favor of the draft resolution please raise their hand?
The message to Tehran is clear. Stop attacking your neighboring countries in the Gulf.
The draft resolution has been adopted.
It condemns Iran's attacks on Gulf countries and demands they stop.
The adoption of this resolution today sends a clear message, a united message from the Security Council that missile attacks and drone attacks perpetrated by the Islamic Republic of Iran that targeted a number of regional states, including the Kingdom of Bahrain, are completely rejected and are flagrant violations of the Charter of the United Nations and international law and the principles of good neighborliness.
Before the meeting, Qatar's ambassador said Iran's attacks are illegal.
Let us be clear. These attacks by the Islamic Republic of Iran have targeted our sovereign territory, endangered civilian populations, and caused damage to civilian infrastructure in the state of Qatar. These actions are a clear violation of international law and the UN Charter.
135 countries co-sponsored the resolution. That is the most co-sponsors of any Security Council resolution ever. The level of support is unprecedented.
Iran's ambassador said Tehran would not recognize the resolution because it doesn't condemn the U.S. and Israeli attacks on his country.
The very purpose of this biased and politically motivated text, which was pushed by Israeli regime and the United States, is clear: to reverse the roles and position of victims and aggressors. It rewards the regimes of the United States and Israel, which have violated the UN Charter and committed acts of aggression.
Russia and China agree with Iran, but abstained rather than using their veto power.
This meeting is adjourned.
The world has now spoken. The big question now is, will Tehran listen? Gabriel Elizondo, Al Jazeera, the United Nations in New York.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty clear indication of the balance of power in the United Nations Security Council. Russia and China agree with Iran. But Russia and China are very big countries.
They abstained, didn't they? They didn't vote against it.
That's because they don't want to upset the other side. They want to be seen to be mediators.
Well, let's be absolutely clear here. Al Jazeera is based in Qatar, and Qatar has been being bombed by. So they are likely to be a little bit biased.
Yes, they are. So you've got to take that into account. The Russians and the Chinese do not want... They've abstained in this one so that they can then, you know, later on, if possible, be a mediator between the countries that voted for it and the countries that didn't, including them. And don't forget, they're much bigger countries. A lot of these countries that have voted for the resolution are basically under heavy manners from the United States anyway. If they voted against the United States, all sorts of consequences would follow, and they know that very well. So they're not actually voting in a, you know, in a free and fair vote. And of course, it's a big question about how representative the governments of the Gulf countries are. They don't have any elections in any of those countries. In Iran, they have elections. None of these countries have elections. They're actually run by oligarchies like the Al-Khalifa family, who were put in power by the British in the 19th century. They're still in control of Bahrain, even though the majority of the population are Sunnis who don't agree with that, but they don't get a say. Yeah. So when somebody in the United Nations votes on behalf of a country, two things possible. A, they don't represent the people in the country, and B, maybe those countries shouldn't exist at all. Maybe there should be just one Arabian Federation with democratic elections for everybody.
There seems to have been an Illuminati-style stuffing of the higher echelons of these elite institutions, which represent foreign ministries, governments, etc., in these countries. That means that they're not really actually democratic at all. They don't actually...
Well, they never have been, and they don't even pretend to be. Meanwhile, of course, we're calling on the Iranians to rise up and create a more democratic society than the one... They had elections in Iran.
This is actually aimed at a domestic population here, isn't it?
That's right.
This sort of propaganda. The people in Iran are just going to laugh at that.
Well, there's bound to be differences of opinion in Iran. It's inevitable. But, of course, in actual fact, a lot of Iranian opposition groups, apart from MEK and other nutcases like that, are based in Albania, are saying that we don't want you to bomb Iran, and it's actually strengthening the regime. Yeah, so the woman that was imprisoned in Iran, the British woman, I can't remember, Nazari, whatever her
Nazanin
name.
Nazanin Zaghari Rekha.
Saying, well, this is, you know, this is forcing the Iranian population to support the government. What would happen here if the Keir Starmer and the cabinet were assassinated and we were told we've got to give up our nuclear weapons?
Well, you mean
weapons?
The king?
Oh, the king. Well, get them all. See, what they did is they were negotiating in Oman, and then the Iranians agreed to all of their demands in relation to nuclear power.
So say we're negotiating with the Russians, and the Russians were to kill the king in the middle of
the
negotiations.
Well, no, you wait until they've got them all in the same room. This is what's so sneaky about this. So the Ali Khamenei was talking to all of his top commanders. He's got to get the military on side. If we're going to sign off this off, we've got to agree to sign it off. So they waited until they're all in the room and then killed them all.
So they must have been using...
And they thought that would end the resistance. It didn't.
No, of course not. I don't think they really even thought that. They just thought, oh, we can do it. Let's do it. Let's kill all these people. But anyway, one of the people who knows quite a lot about what's going on is a chap called Peter Ford. He was the British ambassador to Syria, and he was also British ambassador to Bahrain. And I spoke to him earlier this week, particularly about Bahrain. It's got a bit of an interesting history, hasn't it? More associated with the Royal Navy than most of the other Gulf states.
Well, originally, Bahrain was created by the British Royal Navy as a way of controlling the Gulf. Yeah. So we put the Al Khalifa family, who were a local tribal family, we made them.
This is the Persian Gulf.
Gulf, yes. So the Al Khalifa family were put in power by the British, and Bahrain was part of Britain, British Empire, till 1971.
It's a peninsula, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's not a peninsula. It's an island, but there's a causeway links it to. But the Iranians have bombed the causeway, so the Saudis can't get across the causeway to put down an uprising in Bahrain now, because the Iranians have knocked the causeway out. Okay,
a little bit like, say, the Kerch Bridge.
That's right.
In Black Sea.
Yes, but that's much less vulnerable.
Is it?
Yes, because the Russians have got loads of air defence around
it. It's much longer.
Yes, I know, but
a torpedo and blow it up.
No, you can't. They've tried, and it's actually designed to take it.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Peter's take on what's been going on in Bahrain, because you have quite a lot of Shia majority in Bahrain and Sunni leaders, and they are obviously, many of the people in Bahrain who live there, are big supporters of Iran.
The great majority of the people are on the side of Iran in this conflict. There have apparently been attempted demonstrations against the Americans that have been suppressed with the help of Saudi security honchos brought in, not for the first time, by the Bahraini regime. All this is carefully filtered out of Western media, so you don't get the wrong idea about how we need to stand side by side with our solid allies in Bahrain. Which allies? Not the people, the rulers.
Yeah, what did you call them? The family,
the Al-Khalifa
family dictatorships.
Yeah, that's what they are.
And we installed them there for this very purpose, it seems to me.
Well, of course. Imperialism continues. It was imperialism in the 19th century, and it's imperialism in the 21st century. Same stuff.
Peter's convinced that much of what's going on with this Iran war is linked, very heavily linked, to the situation in Gaza and the West Bank with the Palestinians.
The basic reason for the present war is Palestine, that Iran alone has, in the Middle East, among Muslim powers, has stood solidly on the side of the Palestinians, and Iran is a major state with military capability. None of the Arab Sunni countries has stood with the Palestinians the way the Iranians have, and therefore the Israelis cannot tolerate this. They have to take down Iran. In a way, Gaza was just an appetizer for what the Israelis see as the main dish. The fount of all evil is in Tehran. After all, it's Hamas is nothing more than an Iranian proxy, according to the Israelis, who are, of course, in complete denial about Palestinian nationalism, and who ignore the important fact that Hamas are Sunni and the Iranians are Shia. But the Iranians are faithful to Palestine and the only ones left, the last man standing in opposition to Israeli hegemony throughout the Middle East. They had to be taken down. But it's not panning out quite as planned.
Well, that's absolutely accurate as far as it goes. But, of course, the US have also got an interest in taking down Iran as a major ally of China. Yeah. So there's Israeli interests involved here, and there's also US interests.
But he's
and
saying,
in actual fact, there might be some his wobbling around that.
His key point is that it's not actually going to plan here. That things are actually going very wrong very quickly.
Yep. Well, I think anybody who's watching this objectively can conclude that. They really didn't expect the Iranians to fight back in the way they have. When they did the surprise attack...
Is it because people like Trump and Netanyahu just aren't being told... being, you know, with the military intelligence people and the military and not being honest with them about the ability of the Iranians to fight back?
I think some people that are left at the top in the military in the US are basically saying, well, look, this isn't going to work. But the point about people like Trump and Netanyahu is they're desperate men in the last chance saloon. So they're prepared to take any old risk because that's what they're, that, you know, let's just put, I think, set well, up and look, let's have another look, drink.
I'll just give you my opinion on this. I think you've got Netanyahu doesn't actually care. Because he wants there to be an existential threat to Israel. This is actually part of his game plan, that he wants to have Israel on the brink of being wiped out so that he can get the attention of the United States military and they will come in and help him destroy all of their enemies and they can create their little war there and expand. This is part of his deal. But with Donald Trump, I just think he is not in any way really got his head around the facts. So he's been completely kind of bamboozled into this and possibly blackmailed too.
Well, that's right. I mean, I don't regard Donald Trump as Alexander the Great, Napoleon, or even General Wolfe or something like that. He went to military school and he had to go to military school, which is a private school, because he was too dumb to go to Gorton and the other private schools in New York because you have to do an exam to get in there. So his parents sent him to military school. And, of course, he got 5 deferments from Vietnam, including a final deferment because he got spurs on his feet. So he didn't have to go in the end. And that's why he's, why he's the president now.
Well, yeah.
I think it's an article
called The Mafia Don with a Pompadour, which was written by a German-Russian, gosh, I can't remember the guy's name now, but he was somebody we used to quote probably 7 or 8 years ago quite a bit on this show, and it explains that Donald Trump several times has gone bankrupt and he's had to go back to the Israeli mafia, to the mafia in the United States and beg for money, beg for bailouts. And so he's totally beholden to them. And he knows how to get down on his knees and beg for whatever it is that, you know, so for example, for his political survival, for example.
Well, just like the 14-year-old girls who got to get down on their knees and do something for him. And then the girl bit his penis and he gave him a slap.
Well, this is just an interview. This is just an interview, apparently. But anyway, it's interesting that all this stuff is starting to come out with a little bit of pressure from the American press to actually get the Justice Department to do this. And also senators, apparently, Democrat senators, have been trying to make sure that these bits and pieces of the Epstein files, which mention Trump, are not buried. As there seems to be an enormous effort to do that. But what about the... I asked Peter Ford also about the... just to say about Peter Oborne, it does kind of annoy me a little bit, the way he says nuclear. It's so annoying.
It's an American nuclear translation.
It's not.
It's an American.
Nuclear is nothing. Nuclear is what it is. And he also said something about Vananu, didn't he? Mordecai Vananu. Vanunu. Anyway, Peter, listen, we don't care. You're great. But so I've listened now to Peter Ford, former ambassador to Syria and Bahrain, and worked at the UN too, talking about the nuclear program and whether, you know, what is actually really going on with this over in Iran, as it's been cooked up as some sort of excuse to attack them in a war of aggression.
Well, I have an unorthodox view on Iranian nuclear. I think the Iranians made a mistake years ago. They inherited a nuclear program from the Shah, which had been pushed on the Shah by the Americans, who thought that Westinghouse could get big contracts, which they did. So the revolution inherited a nuclear, civil nuclear program. And there was discussion at the top levels. Khomeini, the first supreme leader, wasn't keen to keep the nuclear, but he was persuaded against his better judgment to go along with it. If only they listened to him. they would have been spared a lot of grief. And Iran is a country that doesn't need nuclear power. If there's one country in the world that doesn't need nuclear, it's Iran with all its oil and gas and hydro because of its high mountains and water, waterfalls, things like that. They didn't need a civilian nuclear program. But they made the same mistake that Saddam made by allowing the impression to develop that, oh, well, maybe they're using nuclear civilian to prepare the way for a nuclear weapon. And they went to levels of enrichment, which were hard to justify purely in terms of civilian nuclear. Big mistake.
Yeah, but hang on. They did that surely because that Trump pulled out of the agreement, which had limited the enrichment.
Absolutely. And even more recently, the Iranians were more or less willing to give up their control over enrichment. I believe they were offering to do shared enrichment with some of the Gulf countries, which in other words meant totally giving up their sovereign right to enrich alone. But Israel is not a country that takes yes for an answer. In fact, I suspect that the reason Israel pulled the trigger was they were afraid that Trump was going to go snap on this surprise, flexible Iranian response. And they moved and preempted Trump and forced him to jump before he was ready.
Well, I think that's a fairly accurate picture. I don't necessarily agree with them about the nuclear power thing. I think the Iranians inherited a nuclear industry, and it was a peaceful nuclear industry. And you know, if you've got the technology, you know, you get advantages from carrying out technical activities, even if you don't necessarily need it now. There's all sorts of spin-offs that comes through doing things, you know, developing nuclear power. And of course, the Japanese don't need nuclear power because they've got all this, you know, very cheap oil coming from the Gulf, so they don't need it. And of course, after Fukushima, they got rid of it. Yeah, after Fukushima, they got rid of their nuclear power. And of course, some countries are going to have nuclear power.
Iran being one of them, it seems to me that the Shah and the Americans tricked them into having nuclear power, so they would always have this excuse to come in. But I mean, you know, it might be that they would have come in if they didn't have. I mean, surely what's actually gone on here, Martin, after the revolution, when there was this decision, do we want to keep nuclear power, the Shah's given us and the Yanks have given us, or not, is that they're thinking to themselves, at some point we actually might need a nuclear weapon, so maybe we should just keep nuclear power.
Well, also, you might need to have the technical capacities surrounding nuclear power, even if you just want to, you know, just to build up your technical...
This is like the poison chalice, though, surely.
Well, no, hang on a minute. If you're going to be put under sanctions, then maybe you do need nuclear power because
you've got plenty of oil.
Yes, but it's still a. I'm not going to argue about this. They, as Peter Ford points out, they've got a sovereign right. They've signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, unlike the Israelis.
He's saying it was a mistake to actually go with nuclear power. They didn't need it.
I'm saying that
they were tricked into it by the Shah.
That's what you're suggesting. That's what he's suggesting, and I'm not necessarily agreeing with that. I think it wouldn't have made any difference because they haven't got a nuclear weapon at the moment and they're being attacked. And they would have been attacked anyway because they represent a threat to the world order run by the United States and the local regional world order that the Israelis want. The Iranians have bent over backwards to come across as reasonable in everything they do. I think in actual fact they've been exemplary in that. Perhaps they shouldn't have been negotiating at all. Just saying we don't have to. They could have withdrawn from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and built a nuclear weapon. And at that point they wouldn't have been attacked if they'd done that. They wouldn't have been.
Maybe. So also attacks on oil refineries and oil facilities. There are all sorts of questions about who's been doing this. I'll ask Peter about that.
Everything the Iranians are doing is very carefully calibrated. There's a lot of deep thought and planning gone into their every move. Their priority is to disrupt the world oil markets. At the same time, they don't want to off too much their own allies, and therefore they're prepared to make exceptions for Russia and China and also India, which is a respectable, neutral reliant on Iranian oil. But allowing these exceptions is not going to relax much of the pressure on the Western powers. We are still going to suffer increasingly. It's only just beginning. The pain is only just beginning. And here's the funny thing. Iranian oil is also passing through the Straits of Hormuz, and the Americans are doing nothing about it. Not only that, but the Americans have studiously avoided bombing Iranian refineries. They've bombed depots which serve the domestic Iranian market, but they've not bombed, as they could easily have done, the Iranian refineries. Why? Because the Americans are so desperate to try to stabilize the world oil price that they're acquiescing in Iran continuing to produce, refine, and export its own oil. That shows how weak and panicky the Americans are.
Interesting, isn't it? What he's saying there about the Americans are actually really being restrained by their own pressure from Wall Street, etc., about what they can and can't do here.
Yeah, I think the main possibility that might end the war quickly is if the top Wall Street people go to Trump and say, if you carry on like this, we're all going to be bankrupt. That could end it quickly. But of course, the Israelis don't have that interest. So the Israelis did attack an oil refinery near Tehran and created a massive pollution incident. I don't know if you've seen the pictures of it, but it's, you know, people are, you know. Now, the Iranians haven't attacked directly the oil facilities of their neighbours. Haifa, the oil refinery in Haifa in Israel, has been attacked by Hezbollah. Now, in actual fact, that is a, if they do start attacking Iranian energy infrastructure like that, they will then attack the energy infrastructure in the Gulf. And if they destroy the energy infrastructure in the Gulf, that won't mean it's just going to be offline for 6 months. It's going to be offline for good. So the whole basis of these family dictatorships, like in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, is that they've got an oil income. But if the structure of it is smashed to pieces, you won't have an oil income. And therefore, you won't. What's another factor that may come in there is that all of these countries have got all their money invested in Wall Street. And now, of course, now they haven't got an oil income. They've still got to balance the books. So they're withdrawing their money from Wall Street. So in other words, what's coming next is the mother of all economic crashes. And of course, the Iranians, because they've been under sanctions for years and don't buy anything much, and the Russians, because they don't buy anything much, and the Chinese, who have now they're now in a position where they're this week they were pointing out, we get more of our energy from renewable sources for the first time rather than fossil fuels. They're already there. They're ready to go. And they've got massive stockpiles of oil as well, unlike the United States. Britain has got, we've got hardly any stockpiles of anything. We are going to go down the drain quick, and our market will go down the drain really, really quick. And then we'll see if Nigel's got a plan for that, since he wants to be the Prime Minister. What's the plan?
Well, I don't think he's got one, has he? I think it's, what's fascinating to me is some parts of the world and some podcasts, etc., are doing a lot of thinking around the implications of all this. They've actually thought a lot of it through, like the Iranians have, about their tactics in this strategy, in this battle that the Americans and Israelis have started. So let's have a listen now to one of those. It was passed on to me by Tali Atzmon, who's Gilad Atzmon's missus, earlier on this week. I mean, it's a really interesting, I think, podcast. The guy is from, we're here being interviewed here, is from Sri Lanka. It's called The Reason to Resist podcast, which I'd not come across before, from Montreal.
Is Western society collapsing? And if so, will it take the rest of humanity down with it? Today, we'll explore this and other existential questions with Indy Samarajiva. Indy is a writer based in Sri Lanka. His Substack, which I follow closely, because amongst other things, he's a fabulous writer, is called indie.ca. I'm sorry, not his Substack. He corrected me beforehand and advised me that he's actually blogging on his own site and doesn't do that on Substack.
Immigration is portrayed as this better life thing. And I don't think it is. I think it can be, but I think it's a kind of a destruction. It's all predicated on life being worse here, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole system is designed to kind of make life worse here so that we become the next wave of colonizers for colonized land. And I think there's sort of like a trauma there, which I didn't understand at the time. I just felt like something was off. But I think there's a trauma in Western society, even, let's say, white people. I mean, that's a moving category, right? But like, let's say Irish, Italian, they would have, like English, European, they would have like left homes and cultures and gone on a very uncomfortable journey and then had to do terrible things and go through trauma to create this better life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of a traumatic process. I didn't think about it at the time, but I think it took me a while to heal from that. But I feel like I'm better now.
As a child of immigrants, I wholeheartedly agree with your sentiments. So let's move on to the question of collapse. That's something that you, you know, you've lived through apparently more than once. Can you talk to us about that experience? And
so I can talk about the most proximate example, which is probably the most relevant. So let's say, I think it was 2022, forgive my years, but Sri Lanka, basically the ratings agencies cut our ratings and Sri Lanka effectively defaulted on debt. And because we're in the petrodollar system, what that meant immediately was a loss of energy. So, yeah, I remember there, I mean, there were petrol queues, the queues, you would wait in queues for like 4 hours. A lot of our cooking is done through natural gas. That was unavailable. So you saw people gathering firewood again, and you could just see what happened without energy. And I think that's relevant now because as the Strait of Hormuz gets selectively shut, it's hitting Sri Lanka, not quite yet, but it's hitting Bangladesh already. It's hitting India. It's hitting everybody. And you can see how much everyone depends on fossil fuels and how much, like how quickly your society can fall apart. Because we had power cuts for up to, I remember we had what, a 12-hour power cut. And after that, everybody was so angry that everybody was out in the streets. And then we kind of like overthrew that government, but then we got put under IMF administration, which we elected a nominally communist government, but we're under that now. But yeah, I guess I have some familiarity with, you don't realize how much you depend on energy flows and water coming out of the tap and lights going on and fans and air conditioning and cars and all that stuff can go away. All that stuff is, it just comes on a ship. It comes on a ship for almost all of us. And those ships go through a sort of 20-mile strait. And if that gets shut down, things can get, they can get real pretty fast.
Yeah. Can you imagine if the energy gluttons and the water gluttons of the West were suddenly without those things? That would be quite a shock to their system.
One thing I say about Sri Lanka, like there's this joke in The Sopranos. It's a Russian telling it to Tony Soprano. And she says, like, that's the problem with you Americans. You're like, you're not used, you expect everything to go right. And then when something goes slightly wrong, you're quite confused. Whereas like we other people, we always expect stuff to go wrong and we're not disappointed. Right. So yes, Sri Lankans are like, we've been through like a 30-year civil war as well. So certainly people in the north, and then also there was they suppressed like a sort of communist revolution in the south. So people have been through some stuff. But then we're a bit more resilient in that way. I think Western societies are a bit fragile, but I hope they get to experience it. God knows they deserve it.
God knows they deserve it. I hope they get to experience it. Western societies are quite fragile. Maybe they'll end up with no water, power. People will be having to chop firewood to stay warm here, Martin.
Well, of course, in developing countries like Sri Lanka, you can chop firewood because people don't live in the kind of, you know, the same kind of technological scenario that we live in. Where I live, and many people live in cities in Britain, you can't just go out and get firewood because you're dependent on central heating or something of that sort. And the same is true of blocks in the great big Soviet tower blocks in the Ukraine. Once the electricity gets cut off, then you can't flush the toilet, you can't use the lifts, and there's no heating, and you can't have a little fire on the 29th floor. And, of course, that makes you vulnerable. Of course it does.
So is that going to happen, do you think?
Well, it's possible to happen, because what's happening, what the Iranians are trying to do, what they could do is smash all the infrastructure, yeah, which really would mess everything up completely.
Well, I mean, are we just here talking about the Straits of Hormuz at the moment?
Yes, I know. So what they're doing...
The point is, can they actually, you know, is it feasible that the West will blame that on Iran, and will they get away with it?
Well,
it hasn't happened.
It hasn't happened yet, because the Iranians are turning up the dial slowly. Now, that could be spoiled, because the Israelis may decide to start attacking oil infrastructure in the Gulf in order to provoke the Iranians to take the next step, because it's the Israelis who attacked the oil refinery near Tehran. And Lindsey Graham, the big pro-war American senator, said, don't do that, don't do that, we want that oil. Now, the Israelis don't care about... The Americans want the oil. The Israelis don't care about the oil. Yeah. And, of course, the people in charge in the West aren't necessarily thinking strategically at all.
Anybody discussing this has got to discuss the potential for false flags. We talked about 7/7, whether it's in Europe or the United States. I mean, this would be the Israelis just ramping it up and convincing European countries, the United States, to get far more involved.
Well, there's been two shootings.
Could they get away with that?
There's been two shooting incidents in the United States, one at a synagogue and one somewhere else, just at the time when everybody's starting to get really, really annoyed about the killing of the Iranian primary school girls. Suddenly, there's a shooting incident, like the Bondi shooting incident in Australia, which was carried out by ISIS-linked people, but it turned into where the Iranians are trying to kill us all. Now, they can use false flags, but they've gone beyond false flags now. They're just going to do what they're going to do. They may use false flags. I mean, it looks like these attacks on Turkey, for example, are false flags. The Iranian government are saying, we haven't fired any missiles at Turkey. Now, of course, those missiles, if they were firing, they would be firing the Incirlik air base. And the Incirlik air base, the Turks haven't allowed it to be used in attacking Iran. But on the other hand, it is still a US base, and the Iranians are within their rights to attack any US base anywhere on the planet.
So actually, the Americans would much rather be using this Turkish base rather than Fairford. It's a lot closer, isn't it?
Yes, but Erdogan won't let them, because he's on the fence, but he's being pulled in different directions.
He's a little bit more feisty than our Mr. Starmer. Anyway, look, Jeffrey Sachs has been on... We use clips from him on this programme. I mean, it's a fantastic... I think he was actually on the Piers Morgan programme this week, making it absolutely clear what he thinks about this.
Iran has held together and will continue to hold together, has vast arsenals of missiles and drones, and we'll see, because this war is not ending in the next few days. And Israeli generals themselves have said publicly this could go on into the fall. And the American public is being prepared for a long war. So even the progenitors of this war are not claiming that this is about to be won. I don't hear that from anybody. I don't see it in the markets either, in the soaring oil prices. I don't see it in the behavior of energy producers, suppliers, and shippers. I don't see it in the shutdown of production in Qatar on its gas, and Iraq on its oil, and the destruction of oil fields. I see a calamity building and lot of blood flowing. It's a kind of mass murder of civilians by Israel and the United States. This is shocking, actually. We should keep it in mind. This is not targeted bombing. This is carpet bombing Tehran. And I've been speaking on the phone with absolutely desperate people in Tehran in the last 48 hours, and it's carpet bombing. And they're killing indiscriminately. So this is a disaster that is not likely to go away. No one's claiming in Israel or the U.S. that it's likely to go away. And the consequences for the world will be utterly awful. And Piers, we have a lot of Americans. We have a very particular society. We have a lot of Americans who are saying, move on. This is Armageddon coming. This is the promised end of the world. We are hearing lots of reports about this being preached in the military. We're seeing a lot of people who believe that the worse it gets, the closer we are to the second coming of Jesus Christ. And that's That's a motivating factor in the United States, I have to tell you. It's a significant part of Mr. Trump's base. And so bad news is not necessarily deterrence. It may just mean escalation to Armageddon. It is a grim situation that we're in. We've not seen anything like it, actually, since World War II. This is even beyond the Iraq War. They then had, I won't say the dignity, but they then had the impulse to hide the motivations. Here, there is no impulse to hide the motivations. It's just complete kill anybody kill everybody and overturn society of 100 million people and an ancient society of 5,000 years. So it's dreadful.
Professor Jeffrey Sachs, I've interviewed you many times. I don't think I've ever heard you speaking with such raw emotion, but I appreciate you coming back.
We're heading to World War III, and we're being led by extraordinarily violent governments in Israel and the United States. And you'll hear a great defense in a moment by a skilled Israeli diplomat. But what they are doing to the world is absolutely unforgivable, and it will be recognized as such. And it's a tragedy. That's why I didn't use the word homicide when I talked to Mr. Dan, and I used the word suicide, because what Israel is doing is committing suicide.
That's Jeffrey Sachs, Martin. That is a pretty extreme thing to say. The Israelis are killing themselves, basically. But, I mean, it's what we've been talking about for quite a while.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, is that if we were dealing with a game theory, we'd be talking about what rational ways can we get them to back down, or how can we get a negotiation going. So the Omani foreign minister would be thinking, well, we surely we can get something. But if people are determined to destroy the world to bring back the Messiah, either the Jewish Messiah or the Christian Messiah, according to their definition, then it's not really possible to negotiate with them, and they're quite capable of blowing everything up because that's what they want to do.
Yeah, so it's a bit like Iraq, isn't it? They've decided to do this, and they've sent out a whole bunch of well-paid propagandists to try to make excuses for it.
Well, that's right, but if you think back to the Iraq War, there was an attempt to try and create a consensus about why we had to go into Iraq, and they made stuff up. They've got weapons of mass destruction, blah-de-blah. What we're dealing with now in relation to this is the possibility that people around Netanyahu and around Trump, and he's got his personal pastor, forgotten what her name is, are basically, they want the world blown up. That's what they want, because they think it's a good thing.
Well, it won't be a pastor, it'll be a rabbi, won't it?
No, he's got a pastor.
Christian Zionist.
Yes, she's a Christian Zionist. She organised the whole thing where all of these evangelical preachers came in and touched the anointed one, Donald, who's been sent by Jesus to lead us to the rapture. And of course, we've got US military leadership. Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War, as we must now call him, he actually believes that this is the end times, and we're going to destroy the world, but it'll be a good thing.
The only thing is, he's on the side of the Antichrist, and he hasn't figured that out. He's not exactly.
Well, it doesn't really matter what he thinks.
It's not exactly that smart, is he?
No, they're not. Well, of course, none of them are. And this is the problem. On the other hand, you can see that the guy who's just been chosen as the Iranian leader has got massive academic qualifications, yeah? As has Xi Jinping, who's a PhD in material science, or Putin, who's a lawyer. Now, you've got Pete Hegseth, who shouldn't be... Marchianov, whose blog I follow, is a Russian naval officer, said we wouldn't put him in charge of a platoon in the Russian army.
Is it going to go nuclear? It does seem to me almost inevitable that if you put all these people who have no real military ability, but they have been put in place because they're Christian Zionists, because they've got this bizarre idea that by killing millions of people and thousands of people, that you will bring back Jesus Christ, that they've been put in their jobs because they believe this, which is blatant rubbish and nonsense, but that's how they got the job. They're actually not very good at professional military people. Surely, ultimately, it's bound to eventually go nuclear, isn't it?
Well, Tony, that is the real fear of all of this, isn't it? Because it just takes one mistake and we're over the edge. And it, that could happen, it could be happening right now as we speak. Yeah.
Yeah, but they're not really saying very much at all, are they, as we heard from Richard Medhurst about the actual damage. So what I'll try and do is put a couple of links on our show page, I will do, to some of the sites sourced from the Middle East where they are actually talking about this, which seems to be very strangely censored from all of our press. There's all sorts of things missing from these. But also the markets. This is a biggie, isn't it? Every Monday when the markets open in Asia, everyone's looking at thinking, good God, what's going to happen today?
Yeah, and I think there's a tendency for the markets to carry on despite the crisis, because don't forget, these people make money by, you know, participating in the market.
There'll be some insider information and suddenly it'll all go.
Well, that's
the
right.
Money will flood from the share markets commodities, etc. Gold, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, that's already happening. But of course, they don't, you know, they've been managing to jawbone their way out of it by saying this will be settled quickly. And of course, you've got this delusion that
it's easy
Trump's
to say
a
that
deal
for the first,
maker and he's going to make
first
a deal
couple of weeks.
Here.
It's easy to say, oh, it will be over quickly.
Well, that's what they said about the First World War. It'll all be over by Christmas.
That's what they said about...
Maybe
that's
they said it'll all be over by Easter, Tony.
That's what they said about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. They said this exactly the same. Maybe Putin...
No, I think the Russians were well aware that it was going to be a long grind.
No, lots of people were saying it was going to be quick, though.
No,
including Scott Ritter. Yes, he was. Yeah, I mean, there were lots of people...
No, I don't think
they
anybody...
Were.
The Russians
lots
are prepared for a long war,
quick.
As are the Iranians. We're not.
Maybe this is just wishful thinking. Now we're into this World War III. Anyway, thanks, Martin. We're going to finish this week with a clip from Matt Eret, who, if you remember back in December, we had this 2025 eschatology conference. Matt did a very good presentation there. But he does a program called The Donut Factory, again, from Montreal. Lots of good stuff coming out of Montreal at the moment. And he sent me this, so you might be interested in this, Tony. Of course, I was, and I am. And I'll put a full version of the interview with, gosh, who was it we interviewed this week? Help me out, Martin. Oh,
Peter Ford.
And, of course, Sabine McNeil up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And with this one, because he's there... What he's doing is he's looking at this whole connection between the Crusades and the Order of the Garter, which came out after the Crusades, but it was a sort of continuity of the same thing, and which is obviously King Charles at Windsor Castle, etc., and this modern Crusade. They do a really good job in drilling into all of that, as you'll hear now.
Now, if you look at those, when people see the image of Pete Hegseth, if they've not seen it already, they'll be startled that he decided that the tattoo he wanted for his chest is that particular one right there, which is the symbol of the Holy Sepulchre, the Order of the Holy Sepulchre that was set up in 1098 to oversee the actual so-called the temple built upon the supposed location where Jesus was put up on the cross. That's at least as the story goes, which apparently features fragments of the cross itself, which is part of the whole cult of the relics. This idea that there is these mystical powers associated with various relics. The hair of Jesus will sell and did sell in the Middle Ages for castles. You know, not to say that anybody could prove that that was the actual hair or little vial of blood of Jesus or a little piece of splinter from the cross. It was basically a giant scam artist movement. But that's made a comeback today, and this guy is a big believer in the restoration of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And that was that sepulchre symbol became the image for the Kingdom of Jerusalem for the 200 plus years that it did exist as a Crusader kingdom. I think it was around the 1290s or 1280 period, 1290s that it ceased to be run by Templars and Crusaders. The Arabs took it back, or the Muslims took it back, that whole area. But there's been a dream to restore it again. And this is also very much tied, for those who don't know, to the belief in the restoration of Solomon's Temple, which is what the Poor Knights of King Solomon's Temple, aka the Templars, were devoted to rebuilding as they made their base under Solomon's stables, which is today's location for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Also, it's a location that is also apocryphally, and I mean, I'm not saying I believe that this is even the location. It's not the location, but, you know, there's a rock, a big stone under there, which is the reputed stone where Abraham was told to sacrifice his son to God and was stopped by the angel before he could do the sacrifice. And certain occultists who believe this shit presume that that was a center of global human sacrifice for the ancient mysteries, the ancient mystery religions. And they've had a fetish, an obsession about reviving that practice at some point to usher in a new age post-reset. And that was what the Templars were also committed to doing under Solomon's minds. And rebuilding Solomon's temple a third time was part of their ambition. That's also what Pete Hegseth is on record. You can go to YouTube and listen to his speech in Israel, reaffirming his devotion to the building of Solomon's temple, the third temple. So he's part of the Christian Zionist third temple cult, and also not just Zionist, more than that, Crusader Templar view. So these Crusaders, what they seem to do is they will use Jews, they will use the Jews, whether in banking to do dirty work and then to receive often the pitchforks of the angry mobs that get burned by the financial warfare and throw them under the bus. They will reward some of those Jews that do their job really sociopathically well, maybe the Rothschilds, maybe the Montefiores, maybe the Sassoons, and they'll give them more responsibilities, but they're always under the control grid of the higher managerials. And the same thing for, I think, today's what's in play now in the Middle East is I think that ultimately those like Hegseth or like even J.D. Vance, who when J.D. recently went to Israel, he actually just bypassed the Wailing Wall and he made a big controversy because everyone's like, ah, you're supposed to go to the Wailing Wall. And he didn't do that. He instead went to the Holy Sepulchre. That's where he spent his time before coming back to the USA. So I think that you've got a movement, and he represents sort of the Peter Thiel unification of the Theobro and Technobro ideologies that are sort of being unified under this new elite. So all that to say, this is part of the thing is they need to use the disposable Zionists in order to usher in a cataclysmic situation that will then purge that land of those people living there in order to justify a reconstitution of Templar strongholds in a kingdom of Jerusalem in a geostrategically more useful place to Eurasia that they wish to prepare to go to war with for the coming several centuries, as it's more just strategically located in the area where all of these ancient civilizations all kind of meet in that area of the Holy Land, as we know it geographically, right? Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, Central Europe, or Europe more broadly on the Mediterranean. Then you have Russia, the broader Eurasian and Chinese civilizations all kind of intersect in that zone. So whoever could keep a dominant control of that zone is in the best position to keep everybody fighting and disrupting any possible emergence of real cooperation. So that's part of the geopolitical material conceptions. But then the thing you and I are talking about is also and primarily the cultural, spiritual strategies here. So going back to the Order of the Garter, I think that the unleashing of the Hundred Years' War was also the third element, the Black Plague, trigger of the banking collapse, the creation of this new Templar secret order of witches. And the unleashing of, why did the Hundred Years' War happen? That's a good one. So for those who don't know, the Hundred Years' War was basically, it was England versus France, initiated by Edward III. And the idea was, well, he's the king. He's the king of France. He's not just the king of England. He's the king of France. Why is he the king of France? Well, he said, well, my grandpa is, Philip le Bel. And because my grandpa is Philip le Bel, Philip IV of France, thus I am totally entitled hereditarily to the kingdom of France. And it's true. Philip le Bel, he wasn't lying, was his grandfather. Why? Well, because Philip le Bel, who Philip le Bel was?
Who?
He's the guy, he was the king that declared war on the Templars. He's the guy who arrested Jacques de Molay.
Oh, okay.
That happened in 1307. where Philippe Lebel of France decides enough is enough. And it began a little bit earlier where he's like, we've got to actually start in 1302, where he said, okay, no longer will I recognize the Templars as being something outside the law, which is what they were claiming, that they had supernational power outside of the laws of the Kingdom of France. Because, oh, there you go. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, King Philippe le Bel of France. Philip IV. And so he said, no, he passed a law that basically said everybody in France, including Templars, have to abide by the rule of the King of France. Nobody's exempt. And at the same time as he does this, so this is war now, because the Templars are allowed to collect their own taxes. They have massive land and financial holdings. Like, they could do whatever they want, right? That's the organized mafia. They're running protection rackets in all of the villages. They've got their own private armies. Like, it's crazy the power that they have. So it's courageous that this guy can do it. And he's also very slandered. Like, a lot of people, they get very triggered if you say anything positive about Philippe Lebel. Philippe Lebel is also simultaneously, and I discovered this when Cynthia and I went down to Avignon a few months back to visit a friend, and we were doing a little bit of research. We went to the Philippe Lebel castle just outside of Avignon, and they have some information displays. And the thing that caught my eye is that they point out, and I didn't see this on any Wikipedia entry or any research that I was doing. I did not see this except at the castle, where they make the point that he actually declared war on the feudal Norman barons and the feudal barons more generally that had brought feudalism into France. That's a big deal, that he was pulling off this massive anti-corruption war to end the for people who don't know what feudalism is, that's feudalism is the ownership of people who live on the land that the lord owns. So the people have the same rights as pigs, pretty much. And they're not allowed to venture off their land to another district if they don't have special permission from the lord. If they kill a rabbit without permission, then they will be tortured, often murdered. That the lords who preside over the local princes who preside over their different fiefdoms typically had total right to have sex with any woman, including married women, young girls on their land. So it was a really bad period, you know, and they didn't really allow literacy during this period. I gotta say, just completely melted down. The written word, the printed texts, was annihilated during this period of the Crusades and especially the Black Death. So this is what Philippe Lebel is declaring war on. So he does this thing. He says the Templars have to abide by the law of the nation. The Pope Boniface the eighth, but I could be wrong. The Pope at the time steps in and says, no, you don't have the right to put this type of limitation on the Templars. The Templars are the personal hand of the papacy, of the Pontifex Maximus. And as such, it is the king of the various nations of Europe that have to be obedient serfs to the Pontifex Maximus and the power of the hand of the pontiff, which is the Templars. And so there's this battle. Now, Philippe Lebel ends up doing a raid right before he could be excommunicated by that pope, because that was the plan, was to excommunicate him, at which point it becomes more easy to do a regime change of an illegitimate king. Before that excommunication act could be read aloud to the public, Philippe Lebel organizes a massive raid on the papacy and ends up imprisoning Pope Boniface, who is the defender of the Templars. Boniface ends up dying in like a dungeon. That's him right there. So he ends up like dying in a dungeon. And there's a fight over like who's going to control the papacy going forward. Now, Philip ends up getting one of his allies from the south of France. I think it's not Avignon, but it's nearby, to become the Pope. And that becomes Pope Clement V. And Pope Clement V ends up working very closely with Philippe Lebel at taking down the Templars. The first thing that they do is they set a trap, and they promise Jacques de Molay, who's then the Grand Master, that, okay, if you come to this special meeting, this party we're going to have for you, we will finally grant your permission to have another crusade? Because that's sort of like the creative vitality of the Templars is crusades. If you don't have crusade, you lose your edge. You peter out. You lose your raison d'être. So the Mollet comes with some of his top, you know, Templar knights, and the trap is set, and they basically get arrested.
So that's Matt Eric there on his piece. It's part of the Donut Factory, D-O-E, Nut Factory, based in Montreal, I think, in Canada. The piece is called The Order of the Garter, Hidden Hierarchies of Power and the Reset of 1348. But anyway, so much in here. I mean, he's talking there about they're not allowed to do printing in the 14th century. Well, no, there was no real printing in the 14th century. Sorry to disappoint you, Matt. They weren't stopping printing. It hadn't really been properly invented. So it wasn't really going on. It was monks copying things and writing. So maybe that's what he meant. But the point is that this is a very appropriate day, isn't it? On a Friday the 13th, as it is, Friday the 13th of March 2026 today, that is exactly what he's talking about, is this battle between good and evil and whether or not a crusade is a good idea. It's lovely to hear him also talking there about Pete Hegseth and his embracing of these crusading ideas. Now, the fact is, many people will say, oh, it's terrible what happened to the Templars. Well, no, it isn't, because although, yes, there was some torture that went on in France with Philip le Bel, the Fair, he also managed to find people who were freely confessing without being tortured about the satanic rites that the Templars were going through. And this was, of course, all being organised through the Vatican at the time, and set the stage, I suppose, for the Reformation a couple of centuries afterwards. But I suppose the point is, if we want to understand what's going on now, I think we really need to see and understand what was happening back in medieval times with the medieval crusaders and the medieval crusades. What is it that's going on inside Hegseth's head? So there you go. I'll put a full version of that up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. I think it's a couple of hours long altogether, but there's an enormous amount of education that the mainstream press should be doing, and commentary that the BBC should be doing, the historical context, but they're not. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off now. Thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to our guests Sabine McNeil and Peter Ford specifically, and to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 p.m. to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and also follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please share interviews and story tips on my Tony Gosling Censored Telegram group, or WhatsApp me, or sling something onto my Facebook page. You can download this show and full-length interviews, subscribe to my free weekly newsletter, donate, or even set up a small monthly sub. Thank you very much if you already do that. All that is at the show page, thisweek.org.uk. So this show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays, and between 11 and 5 a.m. all week on the stream, except 5 p.m. Mondays. The Thursdays when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. We're streaming live now from the Coomber Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com from midday until 3 p.m. Central Time at 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here, and also feel free to make live recordings. So have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. If you've got any money invested in shares, cross your fingers. Every Monday from now on, do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5. And don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down.
the world powers and hated by the developing nations alike. Failed you in that we've left you with no vision of a world community and no education to develop such a sense. It's consolidated, appealing to the people of Britain. Don't support the fascist war started by the U.S. against a poor third world country just to divert attention away from the war they conduct against their own people every single day. Our politicians and entertainers continue to lie to us repeatedly.
Don't believe the hype.
Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously, America number one.
I've been walking in the rain just to get wet on purpose. I've been forcing myself not to forget, just to feel worse. I've been getting away with it all my life.
Getting away.
However I look, it's clear to see that I love you more than you love me. However I look, it's clear to see I love you more than you love me. I hate that mirror, it makes me feel so worthless. I'm an original sinner, but when I'm with you, I couldn't care less. I've been getting away with it all my life.
Getting away with it
all my life.
Getting away.
However I look, it's clear to see that I love you more than you love. Just to suggest that I'm selfish. I've been trying to impress that more is less and I'm repressed.
I should do it inside.
it's clear to see. I love you more than you love me. However I look, it's clear to see. I love you more than you love me. I love you more than you love me. I love you more than you love me.
Nothing!